offered in this hour is for guidance only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. I'll be back next Sunday, 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. In the meantime, if you've missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1, it's Richard Spur, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We'll be talking about potholes and what the government's new plan might mean to your wheels and your tyres. Teachers are calling for a ban on social media for children to fix what they call is a behaviour crisis in their schools. We'll get the truth about a subject the public feel very strongly about, but on which they appear misinformed, and that's the number of people coming to our country. Prince Harry is coming back to the UK for a short while. He wants to bring his children, but is concerned about the possible lack of security he will be offered. We'll get a weather forecast and check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. But first, is America, and by extension possibly the UK, really going to start a war with Iran? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom... Reports from the Middle East are claiming President Trump has committed the United States to intervention in Iran. Several sources in Washington have told the Jerusalem Post he's decided to help anti-government demonstrators, but is yet to decide how and when. Tehran has already warned the US it will retaliate if it's attacked. The former intelligence officer, Dr. Lynette Nussbacher, has been telling LBC the Islamic Republic isn't weakening.
The Iranian government has no incentive to leave. They're very confident that if necessary, they will shoot people until the protests stop.
And there'll be more on this with Nick Abbott over the next hour here on LBC. Five people are in hospital after a road collision in Greater Manchester, which killed three teenagers and a man. It happened in Bolton early this morning. Greater Manchester's chief constable has passed on her condolences to the families of the victims. Local authorities in the Ukrainian capital Kyiv say more than 1,000 apartment buildings still don't have any heating after a Russian attack. On Friday, a missile strike left nearly all of the city without power or heat. Here, the UK government says it will develop a new deep-strike ballistic missile for Ukraine. A competition is now underway to develop a weapon which can deliver a 200-kilo warhead. The military logistics expert Dr. Major General Tim Cross has been telling LBC the UK also needs to up its game on defence.
If we were going to be involved in a high-intensity war-fighting operation, we could not do that at large scale. We couldn't even do it for very long at relatively small scale, because you consume a huge amount of ammunition and stocks and so on and so forth.
The mayor of Minneapolis has warned a deep mistrust of federal agencies in the city is emerging after last week's killing of a woman by an immigration officer. Jacob Frey is calling for state agencies to be involved in the current investigation, which is being carried out by the FBI at a national level. The US-based journalist Harriet Alexander has been telling LBC the current arrangements are sending out worrying signals for many.
There is a fear that this person will be allowed to walk free, that there won't necessarily be a complete investigation. And that it might give the idea that this kind of action is acceptable in the line of duty.
And in sport, West Bromwich Albion have appointed Eric Ramsey as their new manager. He joins the club on a 2.5-year contract. LBC weather becoming increasingly dry for much of the UK overnight. More rain for northwestern areas later, and severe gales in western Scotland will see a low of around 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. As you just heard, the US and possibly Israel have discussed intervening in Iran as reports emerge of a crackdown on protests in which hundreds of people have been killed, according to a human rights group. Tehran has vowed to retaliate against Israel, as well as US military bases and shipping in the region, if it is attacked. The Iranian president has accused the US and Israel of orchestrating the riots, but the regime said that it is still willing to listen to its people. Andrew Fox is a military analyst and Middle East strategy expert, a former paratrooper who served in the Middle East, and he joins us on the line now. Good evening, Andrew.
Good evening.
What do we know about this protest? How did it start?
Well, Iran's had some real problems economically. Their inflation has gone off the charts. And, of course, there are water supply issues. And the regime has been weakened by the 12-day war that was taken against Israel last summer. So there's a number of factors here which have all come together, you know, including religious repression, which, of course, serious discontent with the Iranian people. And so they're now showing that discontent on the streets.
Yeah, and it started quite relatively small, and it's spread. Do we know how widespread it is?
Yeah, it's nationwide at the moment. I mean, in terms of the number of protests, as of yesterday, we were only really sort of three quarters the size of the protests that we saw in November 2022, after the death of a young woman in custody for not wearing her head covering. So these have been increasing daily, and we're seeing potentially millions of people on the streets so far.
The regime say they'll listen to the people. Is there any evidence of that?
Not so far. I mean, it seems to me that they are using violence more than anything else. The previous protests have been resolved by kind of very mild concessions from the Iranian regime, you know, in terms of the loosening of religious headscarf rules and that kind of thing. But this is a slightly different scenario because they can't make concessions on water supply or inflation because those things are almost out of their control. So it's going to be a lot harder for the regime to buy their people off, which means they're going to resort to their tried and tested tactic of killing protesters, taking protesters prisoner. We've even seen reports of people being blinded in Iranian custody. It's all thoroughly unpleasant business, but that's very much the normal way of things for this regime in Tehran.
The presidency, the election in 2024, the independent candidate won, Masoud Pezeshkian. What difference did he make to life in the land?
Not a huge amount at the moment. You know, it's still very much a religious theocracy. Pezeshkian was a surprise win, but even he has admitted that there's nothing that the government can realistically do in the short term to solve people's concerns and, you know, address the reasons for their protests. So, you know, it's very much a case that this is outside the reach of a normal kind of concession-based resolution to the protest. And I think we're going to see it continuing until such time as the threshold of killings becomes so high that people are deterred from going out on the streets.
And part of the protests are about the economics in Iran. How much do its woes relate to American sanctions?
Yeah, a significant amount. You know, it causes real financial choke points within the Iranian economy. But that is really only one factor. And, you know, the economics of this are exceptionally challenging for the Iranian people. You know, when their people are talking about paying £7,500 worth of money to have the bodies of their loved ones returned to them, that's what the regime is charging them. That actually equates to over 2 billion reals. That gives you an idea of how obscene the inflation is. So, you know, the American sanctions have really come down hard on the regime, and that has directly affected the people of Iran.
Now, Iran has got a hardline religious supreme leader. The president is sort of second in command, and the supreme leader is Ayatollah Khomeini, and he is apparently the one that ordered the crackdown on the protesters. Is that right?
Khomeini, yes, he is. He is very much the sort of the religious figurehead of the movement. He's a very old man now. He's sort of 86 years old. He doesn't seem to be quite as in control as he has been in the past, and there's certainly indications that his subordinates are sort of jockeying for position beneath him. But there is also, you know, within the regime itself, a high degree of unity. So it's not as if there's anyone in the immediate kind of aftermath of Khamenei, even if he does move on, who's going to be any more reasonable or any more moderate.
And how much, it was a very religious country, of course. I mean, I think the official stats is that it's 95% Muslim. But unofficially, they estimated that something under the order of 40 to 50% aren't really that religious in Iran. So how much support does this religious supreme leader actually enjoy?
Well, that's probably slightly the incorrect question. The better question, I think, is how does he enjoy support amongst those who are able to enforce the laws he decrees? And that is actually a very high level, because they've spent 40 years purging non-loyalists from their ranks. They've spent years making sure that everyone in key positions is a fellow extremist, a fellow loyalist to the Ayatollah. And so even if the people of Iran aren't particularly religious and don't particularly adhere to the sort of slightly extreme philosophy, the slightly extreme version of Islam that the Ayatollahs follow, that actually doesn't matter because they have the ability to enforce it on 100% of the population.
And in doing that enforcing, are they essentially keeping order where without them chaos would reign, as is reportedly has been the case just lately in Venezuela?
It depends. Iran is a very disparate country. There are five major ethnic groups. And one of the problems with previous protests has been the fact that these opposition groups haven't been able to pull together in one direction. There's been no unifying figure to kind of get behind. The difference this time does seem to be that Reza Pahlavi, the son of the old Shah, who was overthrown in 1979, does seem to be providing slightly more of a figurehead this time and more of a unifying figure. So again, these protests do have a slightly different flavour to the previous ones that we've seen in Iran.
You know, America's got a pretty bad recent history in Iran. Trump pulled America out of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, that, you know, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2018. And we in Britain had a hand in destabilising the country when Iran nationalised its oil industry in the 50s. We've constantly interfered, the West, to make things worse, it seems. Should we be interfering now?
Well, the question is, interfering to what end? I mean, look, the Americans are discussing airstrikes. Mr. Trump promised that he would intervene if the Iranian regime were using lethal force on the protesters. Mr. Trump does have a relatively good track record of following through on those promises when it comes to Iran, at least. We saw that during the 12-day war last summer. The question is what you're using military force to do. And I think in this case, it would be hopefully creating the conditions to deter groups like the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Council, the hardline military units of Iran, groups like the Basij, which is their local militias that they use, their crackdown enforcer thugs, hopefully to deter them from opening fire on the protesters and then allowing the protesters to hopefully make the progress they're looking for and overthrow the regime themselves. But I think it would be foolish if we enacted regime change ourselves. That's a recipe for chaos, and it would be a recipe for perhaps not the best outcome for the people of Iran, and really that's the most important thing.
How would Trump actually dissuade any of the people that you've just described from acting against the crowds by bombing randomly from the air?
Well, I don't think it would be random at all. I think it would be very specific target packs, and of course the Israelis over the summer showed an incredible saturation of Iran by their security services. They were able to hit some fairly impressive targets. For example, they managed to take out the entirety of the Iranian Air Force headquarters in one strike. So this is not going to be a random session of airstrikes. I suspect what they would do is look at the units who have been most responsible for killings in various towns and regions around Iran, strike the barracks of those locations and any key generals or leaders they could find in order to have that deterrent effect. Now, it's not guaranteed to work. And when it comes to airstrikes, it is incredibly challenging to get planes in there and make sure you're hitting the right targets, without accidentally causing huge collateral damage and doing more harm than good. So it's not an easy solution, and everyone encouraging Mr. Trump to do airstrikes needs to appreciate that this is not a simple, quick fix, silver bullet, guaranteed solution to the problem.
And the Iranians have said that they will strike back in some way. How might they do that, do you think?
Well, already we know that the Iranian missile supplies that were damaged by the 12-day war have already been replaced. The Iranian regime has put a lot of effort since last summer into making sure that they can have that retaliatory effect. And there's every chance that should the regime appear to be about to fall, they might go for a Parthian shot and fire everything they've got, not only the Israel, but also other countries around the Gulf.
Right. And that is regardless of whether Israel actually gets involved personally, right?
Yes, because the religious philosophy of the Ayatollah is a slightly strange one. They believe that the Mahdi will return when the state of Israel is destroyed, which they call the Lesser Satan, and when the United States is destroyed, which they call the Great Satan. And if you look at the public propaganda that's been pushed out by the regime, it shows, Iranian missiles destroying both of those places. So it's a very, very strange religious philosophy. Should the regime be about to fall, religious fanaticism can be responsible for some very strange decisions.
To my eyes, Donald Trump seems to regard himself as a world emperor, taking whatever he wants, attacking whoever he wants. Wouldn't it be better for us in the UK to stay out of another Middle East conflagration, to sort of distance ourselves as much as possible from this unstable, warlike American leadership?
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Trump is certainly flexing American muscles in a way that we haven't really seen, since the 18th century, sorry, the 19th century. So it's something that I think the UK is keen to distance itself from. We are also under threat from Washington right now, as not only as Europeans, but also, regarding the Greenland issue. The United States has shown very much that they're not our ally. And as you say, this isn't really the UK's business. But that said, the Iranian regime is our enemy. We have had assassinations on UK soil carried out by the Iranian regime. They fund Hezbollah, who pump drugs, keep people smuggling weapons into Europe. This is a really malign presence on the world stage, sat in Tehran, and we might consider it in our national interest to help overthrow them. But there's no guarantees that any military action will actually have that effect.
Do you think that America is now a malign influence on the world stage?
I do. I think they're a destabilising influence. I think they're critically damaging to European security. And Mr. Trump's new Monroe Doctrine, Donroe Doctrine, as he's calling it, is certainly a recipe for severe instability around the world. It pulls America from being kind of a global presence to a regional presence, which creates a space for countries like Russia, countries like China, to flex their muscles and try and establish their dominance. Clearly, they're both very malign regimes, and America's giving them a free hand. So I find America a very challenging proposition right now.
Yes, and yet we seem to be in the business of cozying up to America as much as possible, probably because we feel as though we're sort of adrift, a small, relatively insignificant island off the coast of Europe and somewhat friendless.
Well, unfortunately, our defence is inextricably intertwined with America for now. And it's going to be a very expensive and painful business to unwind that. We're reliant on them for certain elements of our nuclear deterrent. We buy a lot of defence technology from them, looking at our Royal Air Force fighter jets like the F-35. There's all sorts of ways in which we have spent the last, since 1945, the last number of years, working side by side in lockstep with the Americans. And of course, NATO itself is entirely reliant on American infrastructure to keep it going. So when America's taken this sudden turn towards isolationism and America first, it puts us in a real bind, and it's going to be, in terms of defence, very, very expensive to extract ourselves from that. And that's before we even get to the wider economy.
Yes, I mean, the F-35s, I think we're on the hook for many, many, many billions. We've taken delivery of a few, some of which don't work because we can't get the parts. And we're dependent on America for the parts. We're dependent on America for the technology that runs them. We're dependent on America for the weapons that we strap to them. And we have to have their permission to use them. I mean, it's a pretty poor state to be in, isn't it?
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is down to decades of defence mismanagement. When the Cold War ended in 1989-1990, I think there was a wide assumption that we wouldn't really need, a military anymore. Books were written about the end of history, how liberal democracy had triumphed and everything was going to be good and rosy from now on. Then 9/11 happened in 2001, and we found ourselves committed to 20 years of campaigns in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, deeply expensive. We bent our military out of shape trying to fight those campaigns, and then now we find ourselves in the situation we're in now, where when it comes to Ukraine and potentially to Greenland, we're talking about deploying troops overseas, and we simply do not have any kind of meaningful deployable land formation. UK defence is in a desperate state, and it's going to take billions to fix it.
And just finally, on the subject of billions, Trump's taken Venezuela's oil, the world's largest oil reserves. He's cozied up to Saudi Arabia. He's probably not going to invade them. He's threatened to invade Canada, which is the third largest reserves of oil in the world. And, of course, Iran is number four. That's what all this is about, isn't it? If Iran didn't have oil, then we wouldn't be talking about it.
No, I would push back quite hard on that, I think. I think this is very much about the destabilizing influence Iran has around the world. I mean, you look at the war that started in Israel on 7th of October 2023, you know, that is entirely down to Iran's policy. They're trying to ring Israel with proxy forces. When we were fighting in Basra, we were fighting against Iranian-backed militias. You know, Iran has a lot of British blood on its hands. They've been a destabilizing force, not only in the Middle East, but globally since 1979. You know, this is a genuinely malign regime. And if they fall, as long as something that comes behind them is better, that can only be a good thing for not only the world, but also the UK, for America, for Israel, for any country you care to name.
Good to talk to you, Andrew. Thanks so much for that. Andrew Fox, military analyst, Middle East strategy expert, former paratrooper who served in the Middle East. So what are your thoughts on the prospect of war? 0345-6060-973.
This is LBC.
On your marks, get set, go hybrid. The new Toyota Aygo Cross Hybrid. More oomph than a Friday feeling. And smoother than your last online date. More confidence, more go. In a new hybrid engine with 0% APR representative over 24 months. The new Toyota Aygo Cross Hybrid. Go on. Visit your local Toyota centre. Price from £21,595. Available on Toyota PCP when financed through Toyota Financial Services by 31st March 2026. Optional final payment indemnities may be required. See website conditions apply.
The following is from TfL.
My name was Luna, like the moon. I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So we're talking about Iran, we're talking about the possibility of American intervention, and of course the possibility of us joining in America, because that seems to be our role in the world, doesn't it? Kemi Badenoch is all very gung-ho. She wants us to, you know, start blasting holes in things. I wonder if that's your feeling as well. 0345-6060-973. Birmingham. Hello, Benjamin.
Hi, how are you?
Good,
I'll try not to waffle on, but I've got a main point about Iran I wanted to get off my chest.
Go ahead.
All right, well, so basically, the guest, it was interesting speaking to your first guest you had on, who was saying quite a few interesting points, but it's the Crown Prince who's in America, he's actually called Pahlavi, not Pahlavi. So I just wanted to explain that. That's fair enough. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so one thing I want to for the viewers to understand, who they might not understand about Iran, it's quite complicated. It's not black as white saying that the Iranian government are these religious fanatics, so if you get rid of them with a so-called revolution, then everything's going to be hunky-dory and all the people are going to unite behind the Prince Pahlavi. It's not simple as that. Basically, the problem is with a lot of these Shah supporters who are encouraging these protesters, and a lot of them are shouting his name to come back to Iran for Mecca. The problem is, a lot of them, they go against winning the hearts and minds of ordinary Iranians, because a lot of ordinary Iranians are Shia Muslim. They might not be fanatic like many people in the government, but still, they're Shia Muslim. Mm. And yes, guaranteed, many Iranians, they're very liberal, they might not be religious. However, there are still a decent amount of Shia Muslims in Iran. And the problem is, these protesters, they're now rioting and they're burning down mosques. So how is that going to win over the hearts and minds of ordinary Iranians who might be Shia? And also, another problem is, a lot of these Shah supporters, they will say crazy things like, all these Iranian people in the government, they're occupiers, they're Islamic occupiers, they're not Iranian, you know, we're going to bring the true Iran back. But the problem is, they don't know their own history. Yes, Iran has a beautiful, amazing historical history from thousands and thousands of Persian Empire, different kings, pre-Islam. However, for hundreds of years, Shia Islam has been embedded into Iranian culture. You can't just suddenly turn it off and, you know, pretend that Shia Islam is no longer going to be a part of these people's lives.
Yes, but people aren't suggesting that is something that they want. They just want a better life. They want to be able
But that's what I'm trying to explain. These rioters, these protesters, which many are now turning into rioters, they're going around burning Islamic symbols, burning, you know, anything to do with Islam, but going around burning mosques. This is going to create, it's more likely to create a civil war rather than win the hearts and minds of the whole of Iran.
Right.
That's my personal opinion.
Okay. And are you Iranian?
I have Iranian heritage. I know quite a lot about Iran because I studied a lot when I was younger about Iran. I've been to Iran. I do know quite a lot about both dynamics, about the history side, about the religious side, about...
Right. And do you think that most of the people... And do you think that most of the people in Iran enjoy the kind of regime that they're living under, the strictness of the regime? Because that must surely be part of what the protests are about.
The problem is, it's very complicated. It's very easy for people in the Iranian government to say, oh, it's the sanctions that have caused this mess. However, in a way, they're right. And I'm concerned, what's the point of, if in 1979 they had a revolution to get rid of the Shah, who at that time they felt was too Americanized and make it, changing Iran too
fast? Well, with good reason, surely, because he was installed by the Americans.
Exactly. Yeah. But so what's the point of having a revolution in 1979, get rid of a puppet Shah, just to have an American and an Israeli-backed Shah again? What's the point? So that's why many Iranians, they're going to be confused now. They might not want to support these protesters because they don't want Iran to lose independence. And this might sound really crazy, even though many Iranians, they might not always agree with the Iranian government. Like you said, they might be too strict. However, at the same time, they feel that Iran at least has an independence. And and many people probably hope if Iran could just make a deal in the future with the West, then think we could remove the sanctions. Yeah. That's been the whole problem.
All right. Well, it seems unlikely, particularly as Donald Trump is occupying the White House from now until an indeterminate time in the future. And he's the chap that put the sanctions back on and pulled out of that nuclear proliferation deal. All right. Good to talk to you, Benjamin. Thanks for that. Soraya says Trump has no interest in helping the people of Iran. This is only about his overinflated ego. The irony is that he has his masked thugs on the streets in the US. He is a malign narcissist. Well, yes, it does seem somewhat horribly ironic that people are getting killed in America for protesting and Donald Trump is threatening another country's leadership for killing protesters. 0345-6060-973, Loughborough, Amir.
Hi.
Amir.
Have a good evening.
Yes, sir.
Good talking to you. Just a quick say, as an Iranian who's been here, obviously, most of my life, I left the country at the age of 16, obviously due to the lack of freedom. You name it. We suffer. A lot of people suffer for the past 47 years. I don't know what your honourable... guest was saying earlier, the previous caller, and I didn't quite get that. Okay.
Well, which bit do you mean? Hang on a minute. Which bit did you disagree with?
To be quite honestly, I was on the phone with your colleague.
Oh, okay, you didn't hear it. Right. All right.
Bring my details out. So
right.
When
go
I
ahead.
Get connected, I only heard
okay.
some of it.
All right.
But from what I gather, he was trying to say, what's the point of going back to the same puppet as
right.
As Americans took from us, and then now if they want to bring it back? It's not how it works. Obviously, you've clearly seen the demonstration happening throughout the whole Europe this today and yesterday. And obviously, most an important thing is people out there in Iran, as we speak, blackout with absolutely no phone, no internet, speaking out all on the street, getting shot, direct shot by these besieged militias who have one ideology, and that is, regardless what happened to them, they're going to heaven. This is their ideology. And to get rid of it, to wipe off the Israel, for them to be able to go to heaven, that's how they see this world. And there's no other way around it. And thanks to, obviously, British and French who brought this Ayatollah to our country 47 years ago, back in days, it was so totally different situation. People were fooled. People were fooled by the lefties, by you name it. And even as we speak, the other channels, they speak, they're still trying to divide us. But obviously, this time around is different. I mean, we clearly shown it. We all have one voice, one word, and that is Reza Shah, our king. We want him back. We want him to stay solid with us. And he say, once we go, we all lefties, righties, you name it, they all come to the conclusion that this time we have all decided to be united to get rid of this regime once and for all. Then we can do a transition. We can see the ballot box, and hopefully we can have a democracy
election. Yeah, in the future. Right. Okay. Thanks, Amir. 0345-6060-973. What do you think about the prospect of America piling into Iran in the guise of helping the people who are protesting against the regime? But, you know, as we know from history, things, surgical strikes are no such thing, and it would be a bit difficult to affect regime change from the air. 0345-6060-973. More of your calls to come on that subject. And a poll from The Guardian finds that two-thirds of UK voters wrongly think that immigration is rising. We'll hear more details on that after the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Reports in the Middle East are claiming President Trump has committed the United States to intervention in Iran. Several sources in Washington have told the Jerusalem Post he's decided to help anti-government demonstrators, but is yet to work out how and when. Five people are in hospital after a road collision in Bolton, which killed three teenagers and a man. Greater Manchester's chief constable has passed on her condolences. And local authorities in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv say more than 1,000 apartment buildings still don't have any heating after a Russian attack. On Friday, a missile strike left nearly all of the city without power or heat. LBC weather becoming increasingly dry for most of the UK overnight, but more rain will move into northwestern areas eventually. Windy with severe gales for western Scotland and a low of around 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Ready for that dream trip? From London Gatwick, fly Singapore Airlines to Singapore and seamlessly connect with a choice of 9 destinations across Australia and New Zealand. With daily flights and award-winning service, your next adventure starts here. Fares to Australia starting from £873. Book your adventure today at singaporeair.com. Offer ends 26th of January. Terms and conditions apply.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature and beautiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Upgrade your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and reset your gut health with Biotiful. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
Craig's never shown an interest in beekeeping before, but that's the sound of him buying 2,000 worker bees rather than doing his self-assessment. Craig, you live in a sixth floor flat. The deadline is 31st of January. Less distraction, more action.
Don't be like Craig. Visit gov.uk/self-assessment today. Payment support may be available.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
More of your thoughts about the possibility of America steaming into Iran and, by extension, us following along like a puppy behind them, doing their bidding. 0345-6060-973. But let's talk about something that's a bit odd. Keir Starmer's administration has taken an increasingly hard-line stance on immigration lately, and they have done so with great success. Net migration to the UK fell by more than two-thirds to a post-pandemic low in the year ending June last year. Despite that evidence of the government's ability to control the UK's borders, voters say they've got no confidence in the government's ability to do what it's already done. That's according to a poll by More in Common. A large majority of UK voters believe that immigration is increasing despite it actually decreasing very sharply. Well, let's talk about this with Lauren Starkey. Lauren is an independent social worker specialising in work with refugees and joins us on the line now. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, Nick.
It's odd, isn't it? People think immigration is out of control, maybe because of the constant diet of propaganda from Reform and their enablers on the right-wing press, that exactly that is happening. But it isn't.
No, and you're absolutely right. It is this constant dialogue, and it isn't just from Reform. It's coming from our own government. This talk of increasing crackdowns and toughening up of the system, when in fact part of the reason the immigration numbers got so high in the year that they did was because we welcomed so many people from Ukraine and Hong Kong in that year, which really inflated numbers. But the government is acting like we have this massive migration problem and is refusing to be honest with the public, which is that the numbers are falling, have been falling for some time. And actually, if they keep falling at the rate they are, we're going to be in big trouble because we're not going to have enough people in this country.
Yeah, but in the meantime, it is perhaps another feature of the government's lack of ability to communicate what it is that it is doing. It seems to be addressing that poor communication just lately. But Labour have shifted to the right to address an issue that the public say that they care about above all else. And the great success in tackling the number of people coming here is not acknowledged by the people who say that it is their number one concern. Doesn't that mean that actually it's not immigration that people are concerned about, but the prospect of immigration?
It's that, and it's also a complete failure of leadership and, as you've said, a failure to communicate. You know, the government is bringing those numbers down, but they need to be honest and look the public in the eye and say, we understand that you believe immigration to be a big problem because you've had this constant churn of dialogue telling you it's a problem. But we need to be honest. The reality is we have an aging population, we have falling migration, and as time goes on, that is going to become a bigger and bigger problem. So rather than constantly treating migration like it's a huge problem and increasing the salience of that issue in the public's mind, we need leaders who are willing to be honest, look the public in the eye and say, we need migration.
Do you think that they've actually painted themselves into a corner of the government? Because they've seen how popular Reform have been in, pushing this this message of the fear of the other. And they thought, well, actually, we'd quite like some of those votes, so we're going to try and occupy that territory too. And now they're over there in that corner. It's impossible to get out because there's nothing really that the government can do that's going to make any difference to the public's perception.
Well, absolutely. And it's, as this poll shows, it's a completely failed strategy because, one, they have failed to communicate their message entirely because people think immigration is rising when, in fact, it's falling. But, two, as a strategy in and of itself, it doesn't work. Labour is adopting this approach in order to try and appease Reform voters. But the fact of the matter is, people who want to vote for Reform are going to vote for Reform. The kind of people that would naturally vote for Labour are utterly repulsed by the kind of policies they're coming out with. And we see this in Labour absolutely hemorrhaging votes to its left, to the Lib Dems and the Greens. So this is an utterly failed strategy all round, and the government really, really needs to rethink. It needs to be honest with the public about the need for migration, and it needs to introduce new policies that will encourage the people we need to come here.
It's odd, isn't it, that a lack of immigrants in your area actually seems to make people more concerned about immigrants coming to their area. I mean, places that Reform do well in, like Clacton, almost all white British, over 95% white British in Clacton. So, I mean, is there any point in the government trying to appeal to those people who prefer to ignore reality and blame their lot on the other and stew in a toxic soup of victimhood?
I would never say it's not worth trying to appeal to people. I think for the most part, the British public are relatively sensible people with common sense. The problem is what we keep hearing is this constant kind of screeching from the likes of Farage and Tommy Robinson, whose views are amplified on platforms like Elon Musk's X, where we've got this kind of real, as you say, kind of soup of extremism and this very toxic dialogue. This is what I mean about failure in leadership. Those people are reachable. They're not irredeemable racists. They are people whose views have been kind of poisoned by these types of figures. And we need a strong leadership that is willing to look people in the eye and say, I hear that you are concerned about the cost of living. You are concerned about the NHS. You are concerned that you can't get a council house. We're going to tackle those issues, and we're going to be honest with you that we are going to need immigrants to do it.
I'm not sure that that would work. I mean, it's, to me, it looks like people want to believe they're in danger of being overrun by foreigners because they get a sort of a vicarious kick out of that. Now, no evidence that it's not happening is going to persuade them otherwise.
There's an element of that, but that kind of sentiment generally stems from people being disaffected, being angry, being unhappy with their lot in life. And the best way to tackle that kind of sentiment is to improve people's lives. People don't generally sit around thinking about how much they hate their neighbours and how much they hate other people unless they are missing something in their own lives. So what this government really needs to focus on is a mission of improving people's material conditions, improve their work conditions, their housing, lower the cost of living, lower rents, increase access to the NHS. And what you'll find is when people are happier and when they feel that they are more valued, they are less likely to ferment in this kind of toxicity.
And how easy do you think it would be for the government to actually communicate the truth of our situation is that, like every other developed country, as you've alluded to, we have a shrinking population, shrinking and ageing. Not enough babies are being born, and we're all getting much older. Without immigration, we won't be able to take the tax that an elderly population will need to have their care and their pensions paid. I mean, this is what we're heading to, but it's not a message that anybody really wants to either address as a politician or hear as a member of the public.
Well, I mean, it's a tough message, but it's one that you've just articulated perfectly well in, 10 seconds? You know, it can be articulated. It can be put across to the public. The problem we've got is a government that is simply refusing to be honest with people and refusing to communicate an honest message. We are seeing some politicians doing it. Zach Polanski is doing it on behalf of the Greens. He is being honest and saying to people, look, we need immigration. This is how we're going to do it. He's got a very savvy social media strategy. It's sort of baffling to me that we have a government that is so set on a failing approach that it's refusing to look to others who are doing it successfully and saying, if we, one, want to tackle people's, you know, the issues facing ordinary people's lives, which should be a government's main aim, but two, achieve the secondary aim of not being kicked out of office at the next election, maybe we should look to people who are doing it successfully.
And, you know, there's been a shift to the right by the government, an increase in overt racism in our streets, a sense that foreigners aren't welcome, which may have been the cause of a drop-off in skilled worker visas. People don't see this country as a place that they want to come to anymore. In fact, the people who have arrived here, the Polish community, for instance, they seem to be returning in droves. The number of skilled worker visas is down 36%. Healthcare work visas are down 51%. We're going to miss them when they're gone, won't we?
We will. And it's really terrifying for the people who are here. I work every day with refugees and people in the asylum system. And what they're saying to me is they came to the UK believing that this is a safe country where they would be respected, where they would, you know, their human rights would be upheld, where they would never face the kind of abuses they faced in their own home countries. And then when I talk to them and they're telling me they're experiencing racism, they are getting unfair and unjust decisions from the Home Office, they're having to engage in lengthy legal challenges because of the way they're being treated by this government, they say, I don't understand. You know, I believed that this was a good country and the reality of it has been so disappointing. And, you know, as a member of the British public, I find that really sad that people who've come from authoritarian states and dictatorships and war and conflict and who've escaped, you know, persecution and trafficking, they come here expecting to be safe and then they, you know, they're treated like this on arrival. It's shameful all around.
And just finally, what do you make of the small boats arrivals, which are about 2% of migrant numbers, yet occupy about 100% of the attention of people like Farage and the right-wing press?
It's such an overblown issue. I mean, when you look at the numbers, we're talking 40,000 people, and we keep hearing what a huge number that is. But, I mean, that wouldn't even fill half of Wembley Stadium. The numbers actually are not that high. The problem we have is an issue of mismanagement. We could introduce an asylum visa for people to be able to arrive in a managed and safe manner. We could allow people to work whilst their asylum claims are being processed. They wouldn't be reliant on asylum support. They would be paying taxes, contributing. There are all these solutions that we could offer that would decrease the salience of the issue and would also benefit us as a nation. But we are so stuck in this doom loop of we can't be seen to be doing anything that could be perceived as pro-immigration because the likes of Farage are going to jump on it. But Farage is going to jump on anything. The only thing that's going to tackle Farage is if someone finally stands up and says, actually, Farage's entire ideology underpinning what he's saying is wrong. We do need to welcome people. We do need more people here.
Thanks very much, Lauren. Lauren Starkey, independent social worker specialising in working with refugees. Now, I'm going to take a short break and then come back to more of your thoughts on what is happening with Iran. It looks as though America is going to start dropping bombs from the sky. Should we join them in doing that? 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How it started.
For business rates, I will introduce permanently lower tax rates. The lowest rates since 1991.
How it's going.
If a pub landlord or a trade organisation comes forward and says, we understand what your policy wants to do, but this is actually something you need to be aware of. I think that's right, yeah. We look at it.
It's now a dirty dozen of U-turns since Labour came to power. This one over the Chancellor's business rates bombshell. I heard your stories and spoke to a man who's hitting top gear with his campaign to save the British pub.
We are supposed to be grateful for not being punched in the teeth, which is a strange situation to be in.
It's tears and fears from the hospitality trade, but could it soon be last orders for Rachel Reeves?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
During the Air France rendezvous, take advantage of great offers. Until the 27th of January, book your flight to Dubai from £399 or Hong Kong from £589, from London Heathrow via Paris, return including tax. And from the 29th of March, you can reach Paris and beyond with our new flights from London Gatwick. Elegance is a journey. Air France. To book and for terms and conditions, visit airfrance.co.uk.
The people of Britain love their spin bikes. They also love moving their card balances to a Barclaycard Platinum Balance Transfer Card with no interest for 36 months and £20 cash back until the 29th of January 2026.
A balance transfer fee of 3.45% applies, subject to financial status. T's and C's and exclusions apply. Check if you're eligible at barclaycard.co.uk. Representative example, 24.9% APR representative variable and 24.9% purchase rate per annum based on a £1,200 credit limit.
Wellness. What even is wellness? Cleanses, routines, regimes, biohacks, stacks, schedules, procedures, programs. I suppose so. But can it just be a cup of... Pukka Herbal Tea. Nothing beats nature.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
There is speculation that the US could attack Iran. That is following America's intervention in Syria, where they struck targets linked to Islamic State. Recently, of course, there's also been attacks in Mexico, Venezuela, Nigeria, Somalia, and so on. The winner of the prestigious FIFA Peace Prize doesn't seem to be a very peaceable person. Should we be following him into an adventure in Iran? Leeds, Majid.
Oh, hello. Just before I answer to your question, just I was really incensed by the guy, is it Benjamin, who spoke about Iranian being Shia. Well, actually, I'm Iranian and I'm not Muslim. I mean, I've been agnostic most of my life since I was 15. And also my parents are not Muslim, even though my name is Majid. People think you've got my parents are.
I read that it's about 90%, something like that, a Muslim country. But that unofficial reports put the figure of people who just don't follow any religion between 40 and 50%. Do you recognize those numbers?
Yeah, I would say higher now. The reason for that is, first of all, I don't agree with setting fire to mosque or anywhere. So that's, put that aside, that's wrong. I agree with that. But the problem I see is, and this seems to be with Islamic religion, maybe I hope I'm not being prejudiced saying that, it seems to be very saying, if you're not Muslim, then you don't have a right to exist. Certainly, that's the feeling I've got sometimes. And I think that is the issue. And that makes people go against the religion.
But so, that's not what's happening in Iran now, is it? It's not really, on its surface anyway, it's not really a religious movement against the regime. It's more that, the basic. It's freedom and the economy.
Absolutely, yeah. And mismanagement as well. I mean, yes, I agree with the sanction being wrong. Like all countries, ordinary people always suffer, and people at the top benefit. I agree with that. So sanction has made a difference. But within that, there has also been a mismanagement. Rather than looking after, if you come from a country which is developing, like Iran, you should spend your energies and your resources looking after your people rather than creating conflict in other areas or putting your nose into other countries' affairs, just like how you've been describing America putting their nose into other countries' affairs.
Do you think that people misunderstand in the West? They misunderstand Iran completely, because all we see is people burning the American flag and yelling death to America and so on. But that's not what Iran is like, is it?
Totally wrong. I mean, I cannot begin to tell you. I get so frustrated. I mean, I've lived in UK 50 years now, despite my strong accent. So I've known UK since Harold Wilson was Prime Minister. In all that time, I've tried my best to say to people, I think one of the difficulties here is people are not educated about other countries as much. They're very educated about Europe and USA, but every other country, they see it like the same Middle East. So when I go to among my friends, if I went to a pub and I had a conversation with a group of friends, they say Middle East this and Middle East that. And it really annoys me because, in Middle East, you've got 50, 60 different races that have different languages. You have different, even within Iran, you have different practices. You have different people. And I think one of the biggest thing about Iran which really frustrates me is you just have to get to know Iranians before you can believe it. Iranians are not extremists. I would say 90% of people I know, at least, they are very modern thinking.
Yeah, they're just like everybody else. They want a peaceful, happy life. They want to go to work. They want to have a bit of money to spend. They want to fall in love, and they want to make a family, and they want to have a good time, just like everybody else in the world. But we sort of painted them as being devils. But specifically, the people who are protesting would be the ones that Trump, if he got involved, would be, so he says, trying to help. Would you welcome that kind of help?
Yeah, and I think this is the bit where you probably disagree with me. I was similar to you maybe 4 years ago. I having seen Iranian Revolution in my time, I was hoping we can go through evolutionary process. Just like UK went through, behead Charles I, then women got the vote, parliamentary democracy and all of that. And I was thinking, maybe 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I was thinking this is the direction Iran should go because revolutions don't work. However, now I've got to the conclusion that that's not worked. After 50 years, Iranian regime is still giving the same slogan that it gave in 1979.
Mm. That's a feature of the regime, though, is it? The regime does not reflect the people. The people it's a very young country. It's a
very young country, very modern country, very, very well educated. People know what's going on. They go on the internet. I'm not talking about people. I'm talking about we are victims of, first of all, you were very right because you were talking about British interference into Iran, which actually destroyed Iranian democracy in some way. So when...
Well, it's that old story. Yes, it's the old story about oil. The Iranians nationalized their oil industry and it's the same story over and over again. It seems to be all about the oil. Wherever a country is unfortunate enough to live above a lake that used to be a forest and over millions of years changed into oil, bad luck seems to follow. Good talking to you, Majid. Thanks for that. 0345-6060-973. Vancouver. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Nick. Hopefully, if America decides to invade Canada, the UK won't invade Newfoundland in sympathy.
Well, you are number... I think you are number three on the list of the biggest untapped oil reserves in the world. It goes Venezuela, and then we know what's happened there. Saudi Arabia, Trump seems to be cozying up to them. And you're next.
Yes. And to be honest, I think everybody needs to rethink where the world's at the moment. Asking if Britain should join America in invading Iran is exactly the same as asking if Britain should join China in invading Taiwan. There's no difference between the US and China and India and Russia or any other country that wants to threaten its neighbors anymore. They're not our allies anymore. They're just another violent country that wants to steal things.
Yeah, I don't think that
it might be in Britain's interest to help bring down the Iranian regime, but it's not in Britain's interest to ally themselves with America anymore. Not in any way, shape, or form.
Yes, it's a difficult thing to do, though, because, America goes up this country like ivy around a telegraph pole. I mean, everything that we have as far as our defense is concerned is dependent on America. We've walked into a situation of complete dependency, assuming that the world would remain the same always. But as we know very recently to our cost, no, it doesn't. How's this going down in Canada? Because Trump seems to have been distracted by shiny things elsewhere, Venezuela and now Iran, and he seems to have stopped talking about annexing Canada.
The one saving grace of the United States of America is they don't like to actually lose any troops in any of their things, right? If one single helicopter had been shot down over Caracas, that would have been the end of that. Americans hate casualties, unlike Russia or China that are prepared to lose millions of men. America isn't. And my theory about about Trump's wanting Greenland and or Canada actually has very little to do with oil or natural resources. I suspect that the reason that Trump is going on about adding to the continental United States is just because he knows that once he's no longer president and probably no longer alive, an awful lot of nasty things are going to come out about him, and his reputation as a president is going to be sullied. The one thing that you can't take away from a president, though, is if you add land to the U.S., he will always be the guy that added Greenland. You know, in 200 years' time, no one will remember the fact that the Russians said, oh, yeah, we owned him, or some terrible thing comes out from the Epstein documents. He'll still be the guy that added Greenland. And I think that's literally all this is about. It's kind of the same reason he wants the Nobel Peace Prize. He knows full well that no one thinks he's peaceful, but he also realizes in 100 years' time, there'll be a list of Nobel Peace Prize winners, and he'll be on it, no matter what comes out afterwards.
Quite possibly, yeah, but I would not be, at this moment, wouldn't be surprised if he was still president in 100 years' time. Some way of making that happen. Thanks a lot, Nick. I'll see if I can squeeze one more in before the news. Liverpool. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, yes.
Dennis.
I'd just like to say about Iran and your president. Everybody that I've spoken to in my circle of friends know that it's just the old regime, the old people that are trying to suppress the youngsters in Iran, you know what I mean? And they rose up now against the ideology of the elders, saying, we're in a modern world now. Can we be in this modern world in our own country?
Yeah, well, they can, because they used to be. Exactly right. I'm just ran out of time there, Dennis, but I'll give you the last word on that. There'll be plenty of opportunities to talk about this on LBC in the future, however. Going to change it up in the next hour. The country's biggest teaching union has called for a social media ban to address what they call the behaviour crisis gripping Britain's schools. They aim to enforce an Australian-style social media ban for all under-16s, as almost 60% of teachers believe that social media is the driving force of poor behaviour in school. The Tories have jumped on the bandwagon today. Kemi Badenoch said that they would ban social media for under-16s if they were in power. Do we need just that, a social media ban for the under-16s? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. It's believed President Trump has committed the United States to helping anti-government protesters in Iran. Numerous sources in Washington have told a newspaper in Jerusalem he has decided to intervene, while figures claim almost 600 demonstrators have been killed. Tehran says it will retaliate if it's attacked. The military analyst Andrew Fox has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC strikes would be risky.
I suspect what they would do is look at the units who have been most responsible for killings in various towns and regions around Iran, strike the barracks of those locations and any key generals or leaders they could find. It's not an easy solution, and everyone encouraging Mr. Trump to do airstrikes needs to appreciate that this is not a simple, quick fix, silver bullet, guaranteed solution to the problem.
The Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police has sent her condolences to the families of four people who've been killed by a road crash. Three teenagers and a man in his 50s died when a taxi and a car collided in Bolton this morning. The Justice Secretary has been defending plans to restrict jury trials. David Lammy's been speaking after a Labour MP threatened to stand down and trigger a by-election unless the government scraps the proposal. Carl Turner is a former Shadow Attorney General and criminal barrister. It's being claimed more than 1,000 apartment blocks in Kyiv remain without heating following a Russian attack. Most of the city was left without power or heat on Friday because of a missile strike. Ashton Cirillo is from the Ukrainian Defence Forces. He's been telling LBC the Russians are now using elite weapons against ordinary people.
If you notice, they're not using hypersonic missiles against us in the military and the military targets. They're using them against civilian high-rises in order to try to freeze Ukrainian civilians to death. And so they're taking a missile that goes faster than the speed of sound and unleashes it against elderly and children in the middle of the winter.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security says it's dispatching hundreds more officers to Minnesota following protests against the killing of a woman by an immigration officer. It's believed they're being moved to increase the security of ICE agents and Border Patrol officers. And two men have been charged after one of the biggest ever seizures of cannabis in the UK. Officers from Greater Manchester Police found 2 tons of it during a raid in Bolton. LBC weather becoming increasingly dry for much of the country overnight. More rain will move into northwestern areas later. Windy with severe gales for western Scotland and a low of around 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Well, they've done it in Australia, and teachers here have called on a social media ban for under-16s to address what they call a behaviour crisis in Britain's schools. The country's biggest teaching union, NASUT, is lobbying the government to ban all young people from social media platforms to tackle what they describe as a disengagement in the classroom. An Australian-style social media ban would work through primary legislation and utilise legally enforceable age verifications to force big tech firms to prevent children from accessing harmful platforms as much as they can, of course. John Carr is a former secretary of the UK Children's Charities Coalition on Internet Safety and a former vice president of MySpace and joins us on the line now. Hello, John.
Hi there.
How do you think social media has affected children's behaviour in school?
Well, I can't remember the last time I met a teacher who had a good word to say for social media. Every teacher pretty much shares the opinion of the trade union. I can't remember the guy's name who was speaking today. It's had a terrible effect on children's lives at school. It's been very disruptive. Even if they're not they're not using it in classrooms anymore, at least in most schools, but all the stuff that's going on around, you know, social groups that are linked to the school, is having a terribly disruptive effect. So I'm not sympathetic at one level to the call for a ban, because in a sense, it's what we're really talking about is the failure of the social media platforms to deal with this kind of problem much more efficiently. And so we're kind of punishing the kids when we really should be focusing on the platforms that have allowed this state of affairs to develop.
Yes, that's difficult, though, isn't it? Because Trump is the problem here. He has the tech companies' backs because they've been nice to him. I mean, we've made ourselves dependent on America, so we're not really in a position to protect our young. I mean, we've already been threatened by the Trump administration about tackling Elon Musk's Platform X for putting out child porn.
Well, I agree that there are some choppy waters ahead because of the way that these American tech companies dominate the space, and the extent to which Trump will back them in the end, we'll wait and see. I mean, let's not forget, it was only in July of last year that the U.S. Supreme Court specifically said that it was perfectly acceptable, legally and constitutionally, for platforms to insist on age verification if there was pornography being made available. So it isn't quite black and white in the sense that everything coming out of America in relation to tech and children is going in the wrong direction. So, but here's the thing. We have the Online Safety Act. It's been law now for about 18 months. Under the provisions of that act, every social media platform is meant to be doing a risk assessment to determine whether or to what extent the kind of services they're providing are producing harms for children. And if they conclude that there are risks of harm, then they are supposed to be using age verification to try to determine the age of children and screen them in that kind of way. It hasn't been happening.
But that's marking... Sorry, John. Go on, finish that thought, please.
Now, all I was finishing off saying is that we have a regulator, Ofcom, whose job it is to enforce the provisions of the Online Safety Act. It's got nothing to do with Mr. Trump. It's everything to do with our own laws and our own regulations and our own courts. And I'm confident that Ofcom will do it, although I must admit everybody seems to think they've been a bit slow off the mark.
Yes, and it also, I mean, what you just described, unless I got it wrong, is that the companies themselves are marking their own homework. And any impediment to children being being allowed to use their sites would be for them to certainly interfere with their bottom line. They would lose money.
You're absolutely right. They are marking their own homework, but the point is they have to do their homework. And if Ofcom, the regulator, thinks they've not done their homework properly, then they do have the powers to say, no, We'll mark your homework now because we're not convinced that you're doing the job well enough.
Well, so Australia have acted. Malaysia also, just lately, they have banned social media for children. Do we have any idea yet of how those bans have gone?
We don't. The Australian ban only came into effect on the 10th of December, so it's just a month old. I've certainly not heard any adverse report from Australia, and I'm in close touch with several people over there who are involved in the online world. So I don't think anything will happen in the UK until we've had some feedback from Australia, and I didn't know about Malaysia. But by the way, all around the world, this point is being debated and discussed. Should we let children under the age of 16 onto social media? So all around the world, parents, teachers, and governments are coming to the same conclusion that tech companies have let down our children and it's not good enough. How it's going to pan out, how it's going to, you know, work its way through the system, nobody can yet say with certainty, but the pressure is definitely on.
Yeah, it seems like such a mild response, though. I mean, imagine if it was another kind of product. If almost every child in the country had been made addicted to a drug that made it, that was deliberately made to be addictive, which affected their mood, kept them up all night, hampered their ability to concentrate, made them more aggressive, and which outcompeted with everything else for their attention, well, governments all over the world would be sending out the army to eliminate the dealers.
They definitely would. You're absolutely right. And it's been an evolution. You know, the realization, the research to back up the statements that you've just been making is really only becoming solid and clear round about now. And so we've the right to expect stronger action and swifter action. And, you know, nobody likes the idea of saying to a child, you can't have this. But as you say, if it's bad for a child, you have to say you can't have this. And I'm not at all surprised that the calls for bans are being heard in every country in the world now, pretty much.
Yes, and yet there is no actual statistical evidence that shows that it is social media that is causing all of these behavioural problems. Is it therefore possible that it's not social media that causes people to behave badly? It's that people who behave badly have become addicted to social media.
Very good point, and you're right. There isn't any conclusive evidence one way or the other on this. There's lots of studies that have been done, and there's that famous American academic, Jonathan Haidt, who's completely convinced that it's social media that's causing the problem, and it's not, you know, and it's too big a problem to explain in the way that you just suggested may be possible, that it's the kids themselves who've got the problems and they end up there. No, Jonathan Haidt and others, not just him, do think that social media itself and the addictive nature of it and the kind of content that kids are being served up through the algorithms and so on is the cause of the problem and not the result of the children, as it were.
Right. And if we do institute a ban, just as happened in Australia, it's quite likely that kids will very easily, almost immediately, find a quick way to skip around any impediment for them getting online.
Well, you know, there's a lot of nonsense spoken about this whole thing, about kids being so uber smart on tech that they can beat any system. They can't. Ofcom did a survey, it's a few years ago now, and things may have changed, and what they found was lots of kids, you know, if you ask them a question, can you beat the filters, can you beat the system, they'll say, oh yeah, of course I can, because I'm a super cool dude. Actually, they can't. And even those who might know how to do it, in fact, don't. Or most of them don't, because they understand that the rules are there and it modifies their behaviour. So you have to try these things. You know, you have to try. If there is enough evidence to support the idea of a ban, then there are ways of making it work. And the idea that kids will beat anything that we try and do is just not true. It's a line that the tech companies put out because they don't want us to try it.
Okay, so if the addiction to their phones is so obvious, which to my eyes it appears to be, you see kids who have actually changed physically. They've got a stoop now. They've bent their spines because they've grown up with their head cantilevered out over the front of them, gawping at their screens all day. So if it's that obvious, why aren't parents doing anything about it?
Yeah, well, you God help the point. I'm a grandfather now. But if I had if our kids were that age, going on social media, you've got so many other pressures on you as a parent today. This is a new one. And a lot of parents don't feel confident enough because they haven't grown up with the technology themselves. They don't feel confident enough to deal with it with their children. And they find it very difficult, which is why, you know, we shouldn't always be kicking the parents and blaming them for being negligent or lazy or whatever. The tech companies are making billions and billions of dollars out of their businesses. Their responsibility is to try to minimize the possibility of what they're selling causing harm to children. And I think we should really focus on the tech companies before we start beating up parents.
And yet the parents could affect, the parents don't have to wait for Ofcom to move into action. The parents can act immediately. But do you think that these days, I'm sounding old now, these days, that parents feel as though their child's bad behaviour is the school's responsibility?
I'm sure some parents do feel that, but most parents I know want the best for their children, but sometimes struggle to know what the best course of action is to take to help their children. And so we all have a joint responsibility. You can't just say it's all on parents, all on schools. Collectively, we have a responsibility to find a way through.
I'm going to ask you a controversial question. Might it not be social media in its entirety? Might it actually be poor teaching or a lack of hope, a lack of thought that they have good prospects, the terrifying news that they're subjected to, ultra-processed foods, a lack of connection to the outside world, and so on?
Well, I'm sure all of those factors feed into it. And, you know, not teachers who've been in the profession a long time, they like parents, I was just describing earlier, they may not feel all that confident about trying to address some of the issues that the new technology is raising. But within the school system, somehow, there should be this kind of media literacy. It's called media literacy, what we're discussing here. Media literacy should be a big part of every modern school's curriculum, because schools, like parents, like the companies themselves, like us all, have a responsibility to try and make the internet and the applications as safe as they can be.
And what if we ban social media for the under-16s on the basis that it is causing bad behaviour in schools, this behaviour crisis that the teachers' union has said? What if we ban it and nothing happens?
Well, we won't know till we try. And I think everybody's holding their breath, waiting to see how it goes down in Australia and any other countries that try it. And then I think decisions will follow rapidly. I mean, my granddaughter's school, she goes to Parliament Hill in London. They have a very simple rule. If you take your phone out for any reason during school hours, it's confiscated. And I think a lot of schools have adopted that kind of policy now. So at least within the schools, a lot of problems that existed previously have pretty much disappeared. What we've been talking about now is the social impact of some of the bad stuff that's happening outside of schools on these social media platforms. And that is a much more difficult problem that neither parents nor teachers alone can solve. But we can expect better from the tech companies. They've got the tools. They can spot bad behaviour. They can spot bad pictures and images. They can spot all that stuff. They can do it in the twinkling of an eye. And the problem is they haven't been doing it well enough. That's got to change.
Yes, I'm sure that they can actually monitor how long people are staring at their screens and shut them off if it's deemed to be too much, in much the same way as the gambling industry.
Some of them are doing that. I think TikTok does something. They at least send you a reminder.
Right.
And in China, I think they're not allowed to have these types of apps working after about 10 o'clock in the evening. So there's lots of different experiments going on around the world. We haven't yet come up with a good enough solution that we can all be confident about.
Very good to talk to you, John. Thanks so much for your time. John Carr, former Secretary of the UK Children's Charities Coalition on Internet Safety and a former Vice President of MySpace. So what do you think? There is a couple of countries at the moment who are experimenting with this idea of restricting the use of social media to those under 16. And yet there is no actual evidence to point to say that if you consume this much social media, you will have your behaviour changed in this way, apart from the inability to concentrate on anything else. You know, it's so annoying. I on my Friday and Saturday night shows, I bellyache about this constantly. You go to the gym and there'll be a cloud of haircuts in there, all of which are just gawping at their phones. And they'll put their phone away and then they have to take it back out instantly. They can't not look at it for more than a moment. And if that's not an addiction, then I don't know what is. So even though there is no actual evidence that we can point to that says this causes that, is it just worth a go? Because otherwise, what we're actually doing is conducting a worldwide science experiment into what this new invention is going to do to the behaviour of the growing generation. 0345 6060 973. If you're a parent and you've seen your kids doing this and you feel unable to actually do anything about it, or maybe you have done something about it, then I'd be interested to hear from you particularly. And if you're a teacher, of course, then please let us know what your experience has been. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Hillary's huge winter sale is on, and now there's even more savings for the window wise, with an extra 10% off everything until the 2nd of February. That's on top of up to 50% off hundreds of made-to-measure blinds, curtains and shutters. Plus, keep the cold out and the cozy in with free thermal lining on our favourite curtains and Roman blinds. And don't forget, with Hillary's, measuring and fitting is always included. So get window wise and book your free in-home appointment today at hillarys.co.uk. Conditions apply.
The biggest Furniture Village sale of the year is on now, and it's everything you've been waiting for. Early bird offers in the Furniture Village sale end Sunday.
This was made with human intelligence
and artificial intelligence,
just like Intuit QuickBooks business management software. If you're a sole trader earning over 50k from April 2026, making tax digital means
you have to file your taxes online.
But new QuickBooks AI has
automated tools to help make compliance easier.
I was going to say that. I'll do it. With Intuit QuickBooks.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So the country's biggest teaching union is lobbying the government to ban all young people from social media platforms to tackle what they call disengagement in the classroom. Kids just can't concentrate on anything anymore because their minds have been warped by this constant blipvert diet that they've got, this visual chewing gum of constantly changing people doing stupid dance moves or cats riding around on vacuum cleaner robots and all that other nonsense. Is it worth a go to try to do something? And I do know that there are stories coming from Australia of kids who have seen the ban coming in and have demonstrated how very easy they have found it to swerve around that ban, which you would expect, perhaps. But is it worth having a go anyway? Trying something. See what works. 0345 6060 973. Derby. Hello, Brent.
Hello, Nick, my friend. I'll come at this from a parent's point of view, a teacher's point of view, and a member of that union as well. And I've said this for a long time. I mean, I remember having a conversation with the current foreign secretary when he was on LBC, Nick David Lammy, about 3 years ago, and saying it's like the Wild West of social media. But part of our problem is that you take the phones off the kids, and some of the parents would just give them back to them. So you've got to deal with the other half of the problem, which is societal. And basically educating the whole of society, because schools are there to educate, but there's no point educating the child if the parent is just as bad, and if not worse. And that's part of our problem at the moment, is bad role modelling. And bad role modelling in society, bad role modelling for parents. Because you can turn around and you do this ban, and you get some parents who are weak when it comes to their children, want to be best friends and all that nonsense, and I'm down with the kids. I'm really sorry. They've lost the art of saying the most magical word, no.
Mm.
And the pressure, and I get me, I'm a parent myself, I have a 10-year-old, who is pestering me to get social media. Not a chance. I wouldn't give her smoking. I wouldn't give her vaping. We've had situations where we get parents giving vapes to their kids. Oh, it's fine. It's fine. I mean, the standards sometimes of education of not of the adults is part of the problem, who don't see the dangers, who are almost saying, like, it's not a problem. And they know deep down. I mean, my generation, we've said this before, Nick, haven't we? Like, every generation has this poison, you know, rock music in the 80s and Elvis in the 50s and 60s. But this is very different. What this is, I've got a theory on this. Our kids are going to be the worst prepared when they need to be the best prepared. Because what I can see with them is they have no attention span, no resilience, no stoicism, and the intelligence that is going to replace them, the artificial intelligence, is getting stronger. Well, I can see every generation of our children getting weaker, and their brain capacities, their ability to be resolving problems is getting weaker. The resilience is getting weaker. And this technology is robbing them of the brain development. And I think in future generations, we will say this is a tipping point for sort of our species in a sense. And I'm not being kind of nihilistic about it, but I think I can see the next generation coming behind me, like an older person does, and go, oh my God, where's this direction going? But there's something about this that is different. It is changing completely their ability for their brains to hold information and use that information.
It seems to also be changing their ability to socialise in an ordinary way rather than through a screen. People don't want to communicate with their mouths anymore. They want to communicate by waggling their thumbs on a screen, to the point that people fear making a telephone call. People freak out if you call them directly without telling them ahead of time that you're going to call them. And these are adults now, not even children.
But it's warping their perceptions of things as well. It's making them more scared. Ironically, it's overexposing them to information they can't process. And then you get the tiredness. Then you get the brain rot, which this is the phrase that they use, where basically, you know, it is junk food for their brain.
Yeah.
And it's the lowest level, lowest common denominator. There's no depth in it. And yet we really need them to start to develop the sort of thinking, critical thinking skills. They're too young. They can't process it. Future generations will say, why did we expose this material to our children?
Sorry to interrupt, Brent, but it's an inability to concentrate on one thing as well. People of a certain age now don't watch a film. They watch a film while they're talking to people who aren't there on social media. They can't concentrate on the one thing anymore, and that is what is at the that's what underpins school. Concentrate on what is being taught to you at this moment, not on what somebody else who isn't there happens to think about what is happening on a football field in some other country.
And it is that quality, that higher brain functions, that quality. You say, well, no evidence to be done. Well, we know how the brain thinks. Modern teachers now, in modern pedagogy, is that we understand how the brain is developing with psychological, and we are adapting teaching styles to know how psychology works in order to get, you know, the brain developing. But we can't do that if they can't read, and they don't want to read because it's too slow. Everything has to be instantaneous. We know about the dopamine hits. We know about the danger of online sort of radicalization. We know about the lack of depth. We know that this is causing our children a lot of mental breakdowns. There's a definite correlation between this and a mental health crisis in our young people.
So as a teacher, if the kids were taken off social media, do you think that it actually would affect a change in their behaviour?
Yes, I can tell you why. I have anecdotal evidence from, I took students away on a life-changing experience to a turtle sanctuary in Borneo. And it was a nightmare when they were in the capital city of Borneo. And because they had access to their mobile phones, they were obsessed with getting Wi-Fi. We had one person walking around the city, basically like he was a human antennae, trying to find where the Wi-Fi was. It's like, you know, tinfoil hat job. But as soon as we got on that island, I got those kids back because there was no Wi-Fi, there was no technology, and you actually could sit down and have a conversation, sing songs. And there was just 6 days on that island was like paradise because they weren't jacked in. They weren't like hamsters on a wheel. As soon as we got back off that island, all of a sudden, the phones pinged.
Yeah.
And that was it. They were sitting looking at each other. You're going, not looking out the window at the beautiful landscape in a completely different world. They were completely absorbed. Even halfway around the world, they just couldn't let go of this device. Yeah. But when they were isolated in that place, it was beautiful, Nick. I had those kids for 6 days, and then it was back to, here we go again.
Yeah. All right, good talking to you, Brent. Thanks for that. There's some tales from Australia which sort of underline that. People are saying, kids are saying, well, you know, at first it was like going cold turkey, having my social media taken off me, and I didn't really like it at all. I didn't know what to do, and I was just kind of, you know, distraught. And then after a few days, like a week went by, and I thought, oh, yeah, I'm reevaluating my life. I've been spending all that time just pointlessly and endlessly pouring my attention into this device and getting absolutely nothing from it other than a kind of a sugar rush for the brain. That sounds pretty good result, doesn't it? From Australia, Queensland, James. Hello, James.
Hello, Nick. Good to speak to you again.
Hi, James.
Look, there's been some recent evidence and reporting that's come out that since the ban, book sales have actually gone up considerably.
Really? It's a month that included Christmas. So, you know, a lot of people buy books, presents at Christmas.
I think they'd have probably factored that in.
Okay.
But the other thing as well is that that you see the amount... you would never give your child a crack pipe, and it really is as serious as that. It's so bad. The damage is quite astonishing. But the most important thing, a lot of callers have said, well, they'll circumnavigate it, they're super tech guys. But it's not a silver bullet, and I think the government here took that on board, thinking, well, even if we get 50% of the children off there.
Right.
You see what I mean? It's a positive.
So how has this gone down in... Sorry to interrupt, James, but how has this gone down in Australia, then?
Well, the only people that seem to be complaining about it are the parents that are these influencers. You know, the ones that are saying, oh, my little Johnny can't make 500 quid a week now.
Right.
You know, this 10-year-old that's got his account. And they're saying, you know, obviously they're protecting their financial interests. But these people that come on, they all look a little bit fake and a bit... But they're very few and far between, to be honest with you. Mm. And to be honest with you, the parents here have really, really embraced it.
And what about the schools? Yeah. What are they saying? Have they detected a change in behaviour yet? It is a bit soon. It's only a month old, this thing, and it did have Christmas period in the middle of it. But what are the schools saying?
Well, that's a good point. My youngest daughter's 16, and they can't have phones at her school. They haven't had, well, for the last 5 years. They have to put them in a locker at the beginning, and they're very strict on that. And I think most schools across Australia do the same thing. They have to relinquish the phone the moment they enter school grounds. Hmm. So, but it's worked extremely well. That was the beginning, I think, as for the rollout for the, under 16 ban. I mean, I've never allowed my children to go on social media at all anyway. I mean, I don't do it. And I guess that's just a parent thing, really.
Yeah.
But I think if it's just a start, I think the UK should be bold. Because, look, I mean, nobody's attacked. You see, the point about it is, Nick, and the way I see it is, how can they possibly attack a government for doing something like this, calling it some kind of suppression of freedom of speech?
Well, they can, because...
when it's doing a good thing.
Well, they
don't... But it's doing a good thing.
Right, but they don't appear to be interested in doing a good thing. They appear to be interested, the richest people in the world, in making ever larger amounts of money. That's a sickness in itself. Good talking to you, James. Thanks for that. More of your calls on this to come. Do you have any experience of this as maybe a parent or a teacher or somebody who is of the age that is being discussed here, the potential ban on under 16s for social media? And to my eyes, there's absolutely nothing social about it. 0345 6060 973. As I say, more of your calls on that to come. Immediately after this news break, though, we'll talk about Prince Harry. He is going to visit the UK as his security case continues. We'll hear more about that after this news break with Tim Daly.
It's believed President Trump has committed the United States to helping anti-government protesters in Iran. Numerous sources in Washington have told a newspaper in Jerusalem he has decided to intervene, while figures claim almost 600 demonstrators have been killed. The Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police has sent her condolences to the families of four people who've been killed by a road crash. Three teenagers and a man in his 50s died when a taxi and car collided head-on in Bolton. And the Justice Secretary's been defending plans to restrict jury trials. David Lammy's been speaking after a Labour MP threatened to stand down and trigger a by-election unless the government scrapped the proposal. LBC weather, mostly dry for most parts of the UK overnight, but more rain will later move into northwestern areas. Windy and severe gales in western Scotland, a low of around 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
During the Air France rendezvous, take advantage of great offers. Until the 27th of January, book your flight to Dubai from £399 or Hong Kong from £589, from London Heathrow via Paris, return including tax. And from the 29th of March, you can reach Paris and beyond with our new flights from London Gatwick. Elegance is a journey. Air France. To book and for terms and conditions, visit airfrance.co.uk.
MJ the Musical. The electrifying Olivier Award-winning hit, now in its final weeks. Featuring the jaw-dropping dance moves and legendary songs of Michael Jackson. Don't miss out. Book now at mjthemusical.com.
Start the new year off right with Halfords' biggest ever January sale. We've got up to 50% off motoring and cycling essentials. So forget new year, new you. Make it new year, new bike. New year, new car tech. New year, new tools even. New year, you get the idea. Pop into your local Halfords store or shop online today for new year, new savings. Offers subject to availability. Full T's and C's and exclusions apply. See Halfords.com for details.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
Prince Harry is preparing to visit the UK for an upcoming court case following claims that his police security was nailed on following a recent reassessment. But a source familiar with the proceedings denied that the fate of his security was decided. Well, let's talk about this with Russell Myers. Russell is the royal editor for the Daily Mirror and joins us on the line now. Hello, Russell.
Hello, Nick.
So this source said that claims about security for Prince Harry being nailed on were, quotes, more like an attempt to manipulate the media into manifesting an outcome. Is that what it feels like to you?
I don't know, what a mouthful. I mean, it's a long-running saga, this, and it's been going on for a few years. And Harry has made quite a big deal of his security. It's the reason he says he can't bring his wife and children to the UK. He's popped up from time to time, mostly for court cases, whether that's against members of the media or organisations. But this case is that he's going to be here in the UK in just a few days' time is a rather big one, because it's against Associated Newspapers. And, you know, whether he sticks around or whether he brings his wife to the court case remains to be seen as well, because he's made a big deal out of his security. Now, whether he is granted this review and appeal by the Home Secretary will be very, very interesting to see, because he's obviously lost a court case. He's lost a case at the Court of Appeal. And so, you know, will he sort of be given sort of special dispensation to sort of get around the rules? It's very much what he wants. And that could pave the way to him coming to the UK with his family more often.
Well, what do you mean the rules? What rules are they?
Well, the rules have been, because he is no longer a working member of the royal family. He is essentially a celebrity now. He's left the institution. He has become sort of a private citizen. He is earning an awful lot of money in the corporate world, so he is treated as a normal member of society. You know, we can't have celebrities coming over to the UK and having huge taxpayer-funded security. And so that is the decision taken by the Metropolitan Police and the Home Office when they decided to strip him of that taxpayer-funded security. But, you know, I think that certainly Harry does feel that he has a case, being the son of the monarch, having served in Afghanistan, two tours in Afghanistan, and being a member of the royal family who has had security threats against him. So whether the Home Office now want to take a different view of that court ruling will be very interesting, as I say.
Yeah, you know, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, I mean, they've been on the end of more vitriol and hatred than anyone I can recall, even more than Jeremy Corbyn. And the ill feeling that has caused has meant that they are a prime target for all sorts of cranks and weirdos with grievances. He didn't choose to be famous. He chose to live his own life, just as we all do. But doesn't he deserve to be protected by us and from us?
No, I think you're totally right. I mean, it's actually undeniable that they have been the subject of a lot worse than tribalism. I think that's certainly when I came into this job nearly a decade ago, I couldn't believe sort of how tribal the royal fans and the extended people who take an interest in the royal family, how sort of toxic they could be. And then when Harry got with Meghan Markle and eventually married her, it became very, very toxic on social media. They have suffered at the hands of trolls, and we've even seen there are people serving prison sentences for planning attacks on Harry and his wife. So I have huge sympathy with him. I think that certainly he does have a very strong case as well. As I said, of course, he's the son of the monarch. He is a former British soldier who has had the Taliban making threats to his life. And certainly it is a difficult position, not only for Harry, but the government to be in, because whilst he has chosen to leave the royal family and his working role, he obviously has such a huge profile that I was astounded really when they did take his security away because of his profile, regardless of whether he has left his job within the institution.
Yeah, what do you think is behind the government prevaricating on his protection? They just spent £10 million for a door for their lordships that doesn't work. They're about to spend £22 billion on refurbishing their place of work, which is going to be double what it would be, but they refuse to move out while the work's being done. They're spending about £400 million refurbishing Buckingham Palace. So not about the money, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, when you look at those sorts of figures, I mean, the House of Parliament figures are absolutely astounding. And you know, if you've ever had building work done, you know it's probably going to be end up double that.
Yeah. Plus VAT.
Exactly. And certainly, the King is worth £2 billion. I mean, he is an incredibly wealthy man. He could put his hand in his pocket at any time. Interesting, when I read Harry's book, he said that certainly he believed that it was the palace putting pressure on the government because they didn't want him to leave. We already know that there was ill feeling on both camps of the way that was handled when him and Meghan wanted to walk away from their royal roles. And it does seem rather spiteful. I mean, he has two young children that he says he wants to bring to the UK. I mean, of course, there are a lot of people who feel that Harry has made his bed, so he should lie in it. I mean, he's made an awful lot of money since leaving the royal family. He's done interviews where he's trashed his family. He's sold a hugely successful book where he's earned, I think it was about £32 million was the advance that he got for it. So he's fabulously wealthy in his own right. Well, why shouldn't he pay for his own security? But of course, there are so many issues with his profile. And again, we have the King, who is 77 now. He's had cancer treatment. It's still ongoing. He has no relationship with his grandchildren apart from video calls. And I'm sure that he would want to have a better relationship with them. But, you know, that further begs the question as to why he hasn't stepped in. Perhaps he feels that he can't because it's a government issue.
Really? I mean, if the King wanted to see his grandchildren in safety, he could make it happen.
Well, he could put his hand in his pocket, couldn't he? And as I said, he's a fabulously wealthy man. He could take care of all the financial worries that Harry may have. But it's deeper than that. I mean, Harry feels that as much as he's taken these cases against media organisations, he feels, you know, he's described himself as the dragon slayer. And that's certainly one of the points that he wants to keep hammering home. That's why he took it to the Court of Appeal and why he's written to the Home Secretary to ask for an independent review of this situation, because he feels very, very strongly about it.
Do you think it's the type of security? He could afford security, but not the kind of security that could be given by the state. Presumably, he couldn't bring over armed guards, for instance.
That is exactly right. But also, I mean, one of his main arguments is that his private security, no matter how much he's paying for it, will not be party to the same information as the security services in the UK and throughout Europe would be. So that's a huge point of reference for him. He says that because of the previous threats to his life, because of his profile and his previous service, that there have been consistent threats to both him and his family. And so you can't blame him, really. If he feels that there is a threat, the Metropolitan Police have said that they do these assessments on a case-by-case basis. And if he was to attend events with other members of the royal family, such as when he was here for his grandmother's funeral and the King's coronation, he was provided that security. But of course, he still wants to maintain a relationship with British charities, the armed services he's very, very invested in this country and with the Invictus Games throughout Europe and across the world. He feels that this is something that he shouldn't be paying for, and he's at a disadvantage by not having it. And I think if it does go his way, which I think the Home Secretary will rule in his favour, that that he has a good point.
All the negative press has been pouring his and his wife's way, but how do you think this is reflecting on the royal family themselves? Wouldn't it be better for the future of the royal family if the man to my memory, did he not used to be second in popularity only to the Queen, be brought back with his children?
Well, how times have changed. I mean, that's certainly right. I mean, Harry was always the lovable prince. People were sort of always rooting for him. Very, very gallantly served his country. Those two tours of Afghanistan further endeared him to the British public. And he's always been well-liked. It's just in recent years, over the last sort of 6 or 7 years, that it's been a huge, huge drop-off. And then you have the issue of him taking part in interviews with Oprah Winfrey, Netflix series, running roughshod over the royal family in his book. It hasn't really been the best sort of PR plan from Harry's point of view. However, let's look at it on the other side, that it would be far better for the royal family to have him speaking cordially to them and to not have all this dredged through through the public sphere, because what a distraction it is. The king is trying to get on with life, having cancer treatment. We've had his brother not talking to him for the last 2 or 3 years whatsoever. And of course, it's people are always talking about it, aren't they? They're not talking about sort of the harmonious royal family. There's always something at the end of it, which is either Harry and Meghan or the former Duke of York sort of popping up in disgrace every now and then, and it's something they could probably do without, definitely.
Yeah, and well, harmony is no news, is it?
No, indeed. There's no currency in that, unfortunately. No.
And just finally, without Harry, am I wrong? The royal family seems a bit moth-eaten and staid. It's got the scent of decline to it, of a dusty old relic. The sparkle left the building when the Queen died. I mean, William may be young-ish, but he doesn't act like it. But Harry has that sort of sparkle glow, that sort of Hollywood, particularly his wife. They could bring some of that magic back that was around on the day that they got married. You must remember that day.
Yeah, I do remember. I remember it fondly. And I remember there being, you know, huge groundswell of support, not only within from the public, but certainly across the media. I mean, it became pretty toxic afterwards, but at the time there was a huge interest in them, that they could very much, Harry and Meghan could change the face of this very staid institution. Meghan being from a biracial background, Harry eventually falling in love. You know, it was a sort of fairy tale that he'd always wanted. And there was, you know, huge interest and sort of optimism for the future. And it's when you sort of sit back and look at how toxic it's become, it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I would argue against, it's a decent assessment on the sort of face of it, to say, well, isn't the royal family looking a bit staid? There's various members who are over the age of 70 now. There's only sort of William and Kate leading the charge. Are they doing enough? Of course, Princess of Wales has had her own cancer issues over the last couple of years. But I think that what William and Kate need and want is a period of stability. I think that they can bring that. They're still very well liked. You look at any of the polls that are out, and certainly you could argue the magic died with the late Queen's death, but you look at any of the polls, and even Charles is sort of rating up there sort of above 60%, which I don't think anyone could have dreamt up within the palace when he was taking over. But William and Kate are still very, very popular, not only in the country, but across the world. And they'll certainly be the driving force forward. And, of course, they've got a lot less people to choose from now, don't they? So they're going to have a lot of work on their shoulders.
Good to talk to you, Russell. Thanks so much for that. That's Russell Myers, anytime, the royal editor for the Daily Mirror. Now, we're going to take a short break, then back to your thoughts on what we were talking about before, which is the potential for a social media ban like they have in Australia for the under-16s.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How it started.
For business rates, I will introduce permanently lower tax rates. The lowest rates since 1991.
How it's going.
If a pub landlord or a trade organisation comes forward and says, we understand what your policy wants to do, but this is actually something you need to be aware of. I think that's right, yeah. We look at it.
It's now a dirty dozen of U-turns since Labour came to power. This one over the Chancellor's business rates bombshell. I heard your stories and spoke to a man who's hitting top gear with his campaign to save the British pub.
We are supposed to be grateful for not being punched in the teeth, which is a strange situation to be in.
It's tears and fears from the hospitality trade, but could it soon be last orders for Rachel Reeves?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
go on, leave the never-ending laundry pile, quiet flat, and empty fridge at home. Hop on the train and go into the workplace zone with Southeastern. Whether you're heading in for a change of scene, to share ideas, or enjoy a lunchtime chat with your colleagues, with our great range of tickets, we've got the one to suit your commute. Buy yours now on our app or website and pay no booking fees. So, go on, go in.
Southeastern. New year, new you, maybe. New year, new car, definitely. Upgrade your year with a new Vauxhall Frontera Electric or any car from our award-winning range. With 0% APR over 4 years with a minimum 20% deposit and £1,000 off on top of all other offers. That's a resolution worth sticking to. Search Vauxhall today. £1,000 saving on new car orders ends 12th of January 2026. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, 18 plus. Subject to status and availability. T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature and beautiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Beautiful Gut Health. Upgrade your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and reset your gut health with Beautiful. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see beautifulgutthealth.com/radio.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Matt Rack, the NASUT General Secretary, that's the teachers' union, said teachers are dealing every day with the fallout of social media landscape, which is not originally designed for and not suitable for children. He said social media companies have shown time and again that they will not act responsibly unless they are forced to do so. Should we force them to do so? Tooting. Hello, Jan.
Hi, good evening, Nick. Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I've just got a point to make because I find in the discussion that it's based on an ideal situation of there being a having a single child or maybe several children under the age of 16. But from my own experience and from my own experience of having taught in the past, not just younger children, but in further education, I've seen it for myself how siblings, and I've experienced it myself, how an older sibling, just even a year older or two school years older, can have such an impact on the young, on their younger sister or brother. Mm. And that is the thing that is out of control. And there were cases in the press of how an older child was brought to the intention of being cruel, say, to a family pet by the younger one who had access to the computer. But I myself have been in a class, in an open library, in a further education college, where the younger people can come and study, and seen and have the child sitting beside me looking at pornography.
Yeah, well,
I mean, it's like in libraries, open access libraries, wherever they are, you know, I mean, even public libraries or things, there's no particular... No one's checking anyone's age limit. I'm not saying they shouldn't do it, but I think it's like they're looking at it as if there's a child doesn't have older siblings that can have enormous...
Yes, well, that's true.
Exposing their younger child, right, you know, the younger sibling.
If you ban it for the under-16s, it will cause a certain amount of friction in a household that has children under and over 16. Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that. All right, good talking to you, Jan. Thank you. Nadia in Hastings says, ban anything for teenagers and you will make them want it more. Also, I have heard that it's already not working in Australia. Kids have worked around it with VPNs, etc. That is when your internet address is not is sort of disguised in some way. She says, we need to teach kids how to use it more safely and to teach them critical thinking skills. This sounds more likely to succeed in the long term. Well, yeah, I get that completely. You tell a child that this is forbidden and you're not to have it, then it will make them want it all the more. But I wonder if a lot of children do recognise that they have a problem with their phones. I mean, if they're still staring at them at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they cannot get to sleep because the phone keeps pinging and bonging and they've got a thumbs up from this stranger and a LOL from another complete stranger. And it's constantly attracting their attention. So I would imagine that a lot of them do recognise that they have a problem. It's just that because it's addictive, they can't address it themselves. So maybe it might not cure the problem. It might not even, for all we know, address the problem. The problem might be about something else entirely. It might be about a lack of contact with outside. You know, which kids go and play in the park anymore? Play football in the street. It might be ultra-processed foods. It might be underarm deodorant. We've got no idea, really, but it's probably worth a go to address what the teachers' unions are describing as a behaviour crisis in Britain's schools, to take away the thing that seems most obvious, and that is social media. But they can't do it just in school, though. They have to do it everywhere. And I wonder if 16 is a bit too young to be the marking point beyond which you're allowed to look at whatever the hell you like. Not sure about that. Bayswater. Hello, David.
Yeah, hi, Nick. Yeah, just two or three quick points. Firstly, my niece, she's got three kids, and for years she's been using a screen time limiter. So, we went to the ballet recently, and they were trying to call her to put more on. So it's definitely a very effective way of limiting it. So I'm slightly confused why so many parents feel unable to control the time as much as maybe they could. I think they've been made to feel disabled and they can't do anything, but they can if they just investigate a bit more they can do it.
I think today a lot of parents seem to not want to be parents. They want to be friends of their children.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, you're not their friend, you're their parent. Take charge.
Yeah. And you might have to put up with a bit of pushback, but that's what a parent has to do, you know. And just, there's an interesting class thing about this, because I've been doing some research about it. It shows that in working class kids spend more time on screen than middle class kids, because they're modeling their parents' thing. Now, I'm not having a go at working class parents, obviously, but it's just an observation that the kids are following their parents' example.
Well, I wonder if... Yes. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. But I wonder if part of that is because working class children have less opportunity to do other interesting things than middle class children.
Exactly. Yeah. That's one of the points they made as well. Mm. But I just feel like parents in general, the ones who are feeling they can't do anything, I think they should feel more empowered. You know, maybe we need to have a campaign to teach them more about what they can do. Because there are many more things they can do to limit the time of their kids on phones. Make them feel empowered.
Parenting skills. it's not an outrageous thing to say, is it?
Yes, I know, but you know what I mean. Just make them feel more empowered. Come on, these are kids they're dealing with. You know.
Yes, do you think that that a lot of parents actually just hive off the responsibility for dealing with their children to the schools as though their kids' bad behaviour has nothing to do with them?
I feel I was a teacher, and you did get that feeling at times. The parents blame you, the teacher, for the bad behaviour of their kids.
Right.
So definitely I feel there's that aspect.
And you used to be
a
teacher?
Yes, that's
And did
right.
you feel a lack of backup from parents when a child was being disciplined or talked to?
Well, quite often you had kids who would be late to school and you made complaints about them to the parents, but the behaviour never changed.
Mm.
You know, despite that fact. So it seems like there was some problem, I don't know, whatever, environments where the kids just weren't being taught the right behaviours.
Yeah. All right, good talking to you, David. Thanks for that. Sam in Lincolnshire says that the problem is with social media, parents have to be role models. A parent can't teach a child to do other things if they are always on their phone themselves. I see parents pushing their children in their pushchair while staring at their phone. Yeah, I see that too. They don't even talk to their children. I've seen parents getting annoyed with their young children for interrupting them on their phones. Yeah. Kiri in Somerset says, if they want to ban social media for the under-16s as it causes bad behaviour, they should maybe look at banning it for the over 60s for the same reason. A huge amount of older people are tricked by AI rage bait and by just being tech illiterate into being unbelievably racist, xenophobic and generally terrible. It's not just the young ones, says Kiri. Yeah, that's right. Now, coming up after the news... Oh, this is a bugbear for many people. You ask people what irritates them the most about travel, and pretty much every list you make, this will be in the top five at least, potholes. Dry. Oh, I'm going to sneeze. Wow. That was great. Drivers across England can now see how well their local councils are tackling potholes with the launch of a new traffic light rating system. The rating is based on road conditions and how local authorities are spending government's maintenance funds. The majority of areas are rated amber. Several areas, however, have been flagged as red, indicating significant concerns. Have you checked if your area is in the red? Is your area plagued by potholes? And if you've hit one, how easy was it for you to get any kind of compensation for the damage that was done to your car? Do you think this new system is going to make any difference? 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. Iran's Revolutionary Guards are warning the United States it should expect a harsh response if it intervenes in the country's political unrest and anti-government demonstrations. It's issued a statement calling President Trump a clown and a criminal after threats the US may act against Tehran if protesters were killed. Reports from the Middle East are claiming Donald Trump has decided to take action, but Negar Mortasavi from the Iran podcast has been telling LBC people are torn on foreign intervention.
Some in Iran essentially are at their wit's end, and they think any kind of foreign intervention might be helpful because things can't get any worse than they are. You know, their life situation is not working for them. The state is very repressive and violent, and they don't see any prospect for change. So they're welcoming sort of this foreign intervention, even from the Israelis or the Americans. There's also an opposite camp that says, no, yes, it can actually get worse than this.
More than a dozen arrivals into Birmingham Airport have been diverted or delayed this evening. A spokesperson says its air traffic control has been affected by a radar issue. The airport's website has been showing some flights are expected to land up to 4 hours late. A study is claiming almost 40% of people would like ultra-processed foods to be banned. It also says more than 65% thinks the next generation will suffer poorer health because of them. A police investigation's continuing in Greater Manchester after the deaths of three teenagers and a man following a crash on Sunday morning. It happened in Bolton, involving a taxi and what's thought to have been a Seat Leon. Chief Inspector of Greater Manchester Police, Helen McCormick, has been telling the people it's a very challenging situation.
Formal identification is ongoing at this time, and of course it is pivotal that we get this right. The families of those we believe have been fatally injured in this incident have been informed and have specialist family liaison officers supporting them at this current time. Five other people have been taken to hospital where they are currently being treated.
One of the country's leading debt charities is claiming nearly 100,000 people have used its website since the beginning of the year. Step Change also says the 5th of January was its busiest day for more than a year. Its CEO is warning many people are still feeling the effects of the cost of living. And around 60 firefighters have been dealing with a fire at a recycling centre in southwest London. Roughly 15 tonnes of mixed materials were reported ablaze in Southall. LBC weather becoming increasingly dry for much of the UK overnight. More rain will move into the northwestern areas eventually. Windy with severe gales for western Scotland and a low of around 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Drivers across England can now see how well their local authority is tackling potholes with the launch of a new traffic light rating system. The Department for Transport said a new mapping tool shows 154 local highway authorities rated as either red, amber or green based on road conditions and how effectively they are spending the government's road maintenance fund. The vast majority of authorities are apparently rated amber at the moment. Let's talk about this with Steve Gooding. Steve is director of the RAC Foundation and joins us on the line now. Hello, Steve.
Good evening.
What do you make of this new rating system?
Well, I think it's a very interesting step by the government. We've all been concerned in recent years about quite how poor the condition of the roads are. The more data that can be collected, the more we can see probably the better. What's particularly interesting, I think, is the government's not just rating for the potholes that we all know about and whether they're being fixed today, but it's actually rating authorities for how well they're geared up to plan for the future and get ahead of the problems. So I think that's something to be supported.
Why are our roads so bad?
Well, there's a variety of reasons here. I think we could start with the fact that we haven't really been looking after them well for many, many years. We've not been spending the money that we should have been and making them in good condition. But we have also got the issues of the changing climate, whatever the cause is. The fact is, as we're having this conversation now, it's wet, it's cold. Cold and wet weather penetrates the surface and causes problems. So there's a variety of reasons. Plus, of course, the road network is getting on in years.
Is it the type of surface that we used to use? I mean, I know that if somebody relays the road these days, it quite often is in a very black surface that has is a sort of a pitted surface rather than the smooth, more grey surface that we used to have, which looked more like concrete to me. Is it a factor of the kind of surface that we used to use?
Well, there's all sorts of different materials that are used to surface the road with and to repair the road. And, of course, quite what happens on the road outside your house or the road you use every day on the way to work partly depends on when that road was built. Some of them were built with big concrete blocks that rub against each other and they've opened up cracks. Elsewhere, it's because the aggregate underneath the surface has moved, perhaps because there's been a hot summer that's dried it out and then a cold winter that's frozen it. So I don't think there's any particular change in materials that's adding to the problem. What I think we need is to see the research going into new materials that are going to get ahead of the problems.
Now, the Department for Transport said that red authorities, those that aren't doing particularly well, they will receive what they call dedicated support to bring them into line with the best practices through a £300,000 programme. Well, £300,000 might be a life-changing amount to you or me, but it's a drop in the bucket to the problem that we're looking at. What's the £300,000 for? Do we know?
We don't know at the moment. I'm afraid, like many of the rest of us, I got the announcement earlier today, and there weren't many people around to call on Sunday to find out what the details were. But you're absolutely right. Really, when you're talking about looking after roads, you're straight away talking about millions. That's just the fact of the matter. But I think it is good that instead of just saying these authorities are not coming up to the mark, and basically pointing the finger at them, at least holding out the prospect that this is about helping them get better, not just accusing them of failing. And maybe one of the things that can be done here is some sort of twinning arrangement. A number of authorities are getting a green rating straight away, we've noticed. So maybe twinning up between the good ones and the not so good ones can spread the best practice around the country.
Well, further than that, wouldn't it be better to spend the available budget more centrally? I mean, are local authorities going to ring fence it for roads, and are they the best people to spend the money in the first place? Wouldn't savings be made if it could be done more centrally?
Well, the way that the funding works in this country is that a lot of the money does come centrally. So this announcement today is all about the money that the Department for Transport provides directly to local authorities. Depending on the authority, that can be as much as a half, maybe slightly more, comes from the Department for Transport. And then it's topped up by local resources. One of the things that's looked at in the new ratings that have been published is the extent to which the local authority is adding to the amount the Department for Transport is making available. So I think the incentive is there. If they want to get a higher rating, they're going to have to give a higher priority locally to the money they make available for roads.
And the money that is being made available is apparently £1.6 billion a year. That's last year, which is £500 million up on the previous year. Is that an indication that the government is taking it more seriously or that the problem is actually getting worse?
Well, unfortunately, it is a little bit of both. The problem is getting worse as I say, as a result in particular because the climate is changing and that's having an effect on the roads. But I would also say that after many years, organisations like ours and like others have been saying, we really need to do something about this. I think we have seen this government recognise it's time for a wake-up call, because bad roads aren't just an inconvenience to us, they're actually bad for the economy. And if we want to have the roads performing well, so that goods can get to market, so that industry can perform well, so that deliveries can be made to our homes, we're going to need those roads to be in decent condition.
Yeah, what kind of damage are we talking about that gets caused generally by potholes?
Well, there are two things, really. So one is our colleagues in the RAC breakdown company report on the damage to vehicles, literally vehicles breaking down because they've hit a pothole and it's knocked a wheel out of alignment or it's damaged the suspension. That can happen. It's something that definitely occurs in the logistics world, where there's damage to lorry suspension, damage to wheels and things like that. But also, as soon as you've done that, particularly if you're in the logistics world, once you've got a damaged truck, that's taken out of circulation, that driver's not working today because you've had to rejig everything, the knock-on effects can be quite serious.
Yeah, apparently it's £1.7 billion worth of damage to vehicles and circumstances that you just mentioned a year, £1.7 billion a year. And similarly, but it's the same figures, but without the dot in between, the local government association says there's a £17 billion backlog of road repairs. How has it got to be so much?
Well, I think it's always difficult with the sort of scale of telephone number figures that are bandied about for the scale of damage and the scale of backlog. I think the problem with the backlog is it implies that once we've sorted out the roads, once we took the potholes, job done, we can focus on other things. What we actually need is consistent funding year by year, perhaps backed up by the development of new materials that work better, that that weather better. But it's a fallacy to think that if we could ever just fill up the backlog. What we need to do, and what I think this government is trying to do here with its allocations looking several years ahead, is to say, this is the amount of money that we're going to have. We've got to spend money in all sorts of other things, like the health service and education, but we've genuinely provided more for maintenance. We're telling you how much that's going to be looking at over the next few years, so you can plan ahead. Now we need to make sure we get the absolute best value from that money, and that's what this rating is all about.
You know, when somebody does go into a pothole and they find that their car doesn't work anymore, their tyres have been shredded or the wheels bent and the shock absorbers have gone and so on, in your company's experience, how easy is it for people to get compensation for the damage that they've got to their vehicles?
Well, I'm afraid I can speak from personal experience here. It's extremely hard to get compensation, because the way the system works, if the highway authority is aware of a fault to the road and it passes a certain threshold that it's likely to cause a problem, it's likely to cause damage, then they need to get on top of that straight away. They need to send their term contractor out to get it patched. It might not be a permanent repair, but they need to get it patched, or they need to put some sort of warning sign so that people don't hit it at speed and damage their vehicle. If they're following their own procedures, it's extremely hard to say, well, I was driving, you might have known that there was a fault in the road there, but I hit it in such a way as it damaged my vehicle. They can generally defend themselves against that by saying, we followed our policy. Either it wasn't quite as deep as it needed to be for an emergency repair, or that we put, sometimes you'll see the paint markings around them, that it was down to you as the driver should have seen that. So it's actually very, very difficult to make claims stick against local authorities. Still worth doing, still worth checking, because the amounts of money can rack up. I lost a £100 tyre myself only about 3 weeks ago to potholes here in West Sussex. So it's always worth checking, but I also think for the time being, we've all got to be aware as drivers that the roads just aren't in the condition we'd like them to be.
Yeah, what if it's raining, though? Because you can't see them when they're wet. If it's filled up with water, it just looks like the road.
That is a particular problem, and that is why I would say if you have suffered damage to your vehicle, it is always worth challenging the authority on that and checking whether you can get compensation if your vehicle has been damaged. It is extremely difficult. You're absolutely right. At the moment, a pothole can be filled with water. Potentially in a week or so's time, or in the north of the country, it could be covered by ice or by snow. I'm afraid we have to be careful. We have to think about the fact that we're driving on roads every day. We know that they're not in the condition we'd like them to be. We need to exercise caution, but sometimes, of course, that's just not enough and the vehicle still gets damaged.
Yeah, and of course, it's one thing to hit one of these things in a car, but something else completely if you're on a bike.
Well, I ride a motorbike. I have occasionally ridden a bicycle. I can absolutely vouch for the fact that on either of those vehicles, something that's annoying in a car, you probably wouldn't even notice in a truck, but it can tip you off and be a very serious issue. And since the government is trying to encourage us all to get out there and ride bicycles, I think that might just be part of why they are taking the issue more seriously. They are putting some more money on the table, and local authorities who are trying to encourage us to do that also are taking this. It's gone up the political agenda, definitely, at a national level, and for many of those authorities on the map the department's published today, clearly it's something that councillors realise their constituents are worried about.
Very good to talk to you, Steve. Thanks so much for that. That's Steve Gooding, director of the RAC Foundation. So when people are asked what is the thing that irks them the most, potholes is right up there. So how is it where you live? And if you've hit one, did you manage to get any compensation? Because according to Steve, it's a difficult thing to achieve. 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850, email nicka@lbc.co.uk. If you are on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They have fatal incompetence.
Straight to the point.
What is the problem they've got over there?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The country's going backwards. Growth down. Energy prices up.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
The following is from TFL.
I got loads of flowers the other day. And messages from people I didn't even know. My mates spelled out my name in tea lights. And my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings. Next to the lamppost, where I got killed. By a nice lady. Just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the content production industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Daisy, a technical content production student in year 12.
We've already learned how to create content and work with employers in the media industry. I love working in the studio, making my own podcast, and can't wait to start my 45-day work placement next term.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So potholes is a bugbear of your average driver, but if you're on a bike, it's much, much worse than that. It could be life or death, not just shredding your tyres and ruining your shock absorbers. So what do you make of this new policy from the government? Drivers across England, I don't know about the rest of the country, but England can now see how well their local authority is tackling potholes with the launch of a new traffic light rating system. The vast majority of authorities are rated as amber, which I guess means it's not as bad as it could be, but it's not as good as it could be. Among those classified as red, needing a special attention, are Cumberland, Cumbria, Bolton, Greater Manchester, Leicestershire, Suffolk, and, oddly, Kensington and Chelsea in West London, who must have no end of money. I would have thought that their roads would be billiard table smooth. But assuming that red means bad, then they need to do a lot more work. What's it like where you are? 0345 6060 973. Oldbury. Hello, Rangers.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for taking my call, yeah.
You know, on this, can I give you a comparison, yeah?
Yeah.
You know when you got that ticket for parking illegally?
Yes. It wasn't illegal. No, they don't make me go over that ground
again. According
to
them, it was illegal.
According to them, it was illegal, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you had to contest it, yeah?
I contested it, and they didn't look at my appeal, I don't think, because they dismissed it out of hand. But I think that they do that in order to make you give up and go away.
Okay. Last year, I drove over a pothole, and I had to get a new tyre. It cost me £230 plus VAT.
Wow.
So I should be able to send that as a... my claim to my local authority to say you was responsible for that.
Right.
Right. Until you contest it, I'm going to double it.
Well, that's what they do until with a parking ticket. Yes. We will.
No,
that if you pay it within 14 days, then it's at £80. If you wait after 14 days, then it becomes £160. And the kicker is you can only appeal after it becomes £160, making you gamble, essentially, that you're going to get the attention of someone who is a reasonable person who isn't intent on taking your money.
Yeah, so to me, right, forget about weather conditions and ice or whatever. I mean, in my last life, I was a HUV driver. I drove articulated lorries, I know how to judge the road, yeah? Okay? So if I'm driving along from my house to one of my suppliers, yeah?
Yeah, regular route.
And I go through a pothole, and my tyre gets damaged, and I look at it, take pictures, I claim against my local council, it should be the same principle as what you had to pay for your parking ticket. Right? Until they can contest it, it will double every time.
Well, that seems reasonable, yes. I mean, if they can do it, then we should be able to do it too. So when you went into the pothole, and that's an expensive tyre, £250, did you actually try to get money back from the council who was responsible for that road?
Unfortunately, I didn't, because I listen to your kind of programs, and I know it's a non-event. It's not going to happen, yeah?
Well, you know it's not going to happen if you don't do it. You can be absolutely certain.
I will do it the next time.
Right, okay.
I will do it the next. There's so many potholes everywhere, yeah? And you know what? All the councils throughout this country, they've got people who are supporting them, like, you know, your parking ticket. Oh, mate, listen, you know, let Nick Abbott just pay half of it and we'll get away with it. We need now to stop these kind of things happening, right? There's potholes all around the country. You know, on the motorways, that's safe. Yeah? On the side roads, everywhere they are. We should
motorways, there was a story, it was so bad, there was a story in the paper the other day about, I think it was a slip road off the M3, and dozens of cars were not totaled exactly, but they had, they had replacement tyres, and their shock absorbers gone, and they had their rims were bent out of shape, and so you don't often see a pothole on a motorway. And if there is one, then you're usually on it way too quick for you to do anything about it. And it becomes much more potentially dangerous than on an ordinary road.
Nick, my philosophy is, let's use reverse psychology then. If they can fine you for a parking ticket, then you have to contest it. I want to fine them for a pothole until they can contest it. See how many people throughout the country can contest that. I mean, that's just one of my things where I lost a tyre. Yeah? It's happening all the time. And we should be able to now hold them to account. So you can offer Nick Abbott a ticket for 15 metres away from, or 15.9, whatever. I don't understand the kind of things, yeah? we should be able to use reverse psychology
I don't think it's reverse psychology. I think it's using their approach to harm, as they would see it, me supposedly parking illegally when I absolutely, totally and definitely was not. I was adhering to their very specific instructions, precisely, and they just, they had made a mistake in identifying precisely where it was that you weren't supposed to park, because they didn't, they presumably don't know how big the parking bay is. This is the background to what it is that Ranjit's talking about. They thought the parking bay was 15 metres, so that's what they prohibited. But it isn't 15 metres, 25 metres. And so I parked beyond the point at which they had prohibited parking, and they refused to accept that fact. I mean, it's not like 15 metres is an idea. It's not a feeling. It's a measurement. And it's so annoying dealing with these people, and I imagine it's exactly like dealing with the local council for a pothole, because the people, the council that issues a parking ticket, they want your money. And the people who are responsible for the roads that you damage your car in, they don't want to give you any money. It's part of the same problem. It's just pushing in opposite directions. All right, thanks for that, Ranjit. Good idea. Yeah, we should fine them and then double it for every 14 days or so that they refuse to pay up. Yeah, why not? That is absolutely outrageous, though. It's just, it's burning my brow just thinking about it. Do not park within 15 metres of this sign, they said, so I didn't. I parked in that bay, but 25 metres away. It's just that they think that the bay is 15 metres, but it's not, it's 25. And I appealed the ticket, and they said, no, you are to blame. I actually had a conversation with the guy who gave the ticket to me, and he said that he had called in and checked with them, and they meant the whole bay. But that's not what they'd written. That's not what was on the sign. And so I appealed the ticket, and they still refused to accept that. Like I'm supposed to be some sort of mind reader. So I'm going to gamble, because I mean, I'm not normally a gambling person. I mean, the sensible thing, I suppose, would be to just pay the 80 quid and get along with your life. But I don't owe them 80 quid. It seems wholly unreasonable to ask me to pay that. So I'm going to risk having to pay £160, because only when it goes up to 160 can you appeal the appeal. Which seems like a con job to me. But anyway, it's not what we're talking about, but it's related. I think the attitude is the same. If a council is responsible for a pothole in the road and you damage your car by driving into it, they should pay the bill that they caused by their incompetence and inactivity. But they won't. They'll fight tooth and nail not to have to pay up. Nadia in Hastings says, so, this government's attitude to potholes, very different to the last Tory government then. They just ignored them and hoped that local councils rather than them would get the blame. Small state, less tax, leads to a build-up of potholes. Well, there does seem to be a build-up. I mean, the numbers are just amazing. We have 17... billion pounds worth of backlog to fix. I mean, that's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? 17 billion pounds a backlog of road repairs. And it didn't come in the last year, it came in the last 14 or 15 as it is now. So, yeah, Nadia, I think you're completely correct. No point in blaming Keir Starmer, it's got nothing to do with him. Gerard says, I've been riding a push bike for over a decade, every day to and from work. I spend more time concentrating on the treacherous potholes than the deranged car drivers. Well, yeah, I mean, I drive pretty much the same route every time I come to work, and I have memorised where the potholes are. Some of them are absolutely colossal. I mean, you would lose a tyre if you went through, you'd lose a wheel if you went through one. And so it's very good to remember where they are. If you do the same trip over and over again, then you can pretty much, I wouldn't advise this, but you can do it blindfold. I know where they are, so I can avoid them. What is a little bit terrifying is going on a different route, because there may be, you know, roadworks ahead, so your sat-nav will send you somewhere else, and then you don't know where they are. And that is really alarming, particularly when it's raining, because you just can't tell where they are. Stephen in Somerset says, when out on a routine 3-mile fitness run in our lanes, especially in dark, I need to be careful not to twist an ankle. Yeah. And JP says, with a lot of our infrastructure needing long-term persistent planning, not finish this list and wait for another backlog list to build up. We need long-term strategies for all key and essential services, strategies that spans multiple governments. Well, that is a good reason to stick with the one that we have, I guess. Because if it's somebody else, then they will be charging in the opposite direction. And then we'll get nothing done. All right, thanks for that. Sorry I couldn't get through to all of your calls. Now, we're going to talk about the weather after the news. There's been a lot of it about. As you know, we're going to be talking to John Ketley about the weather, and we will also check in with our US correspondent, Simon Marks. It's 12:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Iran's Revolutionary Guards are warning the United States it should expect a harsh response if it intervenes in the country's political unrest. It's issued a statement calling President Trump a clown and a criminal after threats the US may act against Tehran. More than a dozen arrivals into Birmingham's airport have been diverted or delayed this evening. A spokesperson says its air traffic control's been affected by a radar issue. And a study is claiming almost 40% of people would like ultra-processed foods to be banned. It says more than 65% of them think their next generation will suffer poorer health. LBC weather becoming increasingly dry for much of the UK overnight. More rain, though, will eventually move into northwestern areas. Severe gales for the west of Scotland with a low of around 7 degrees.
LBC.
Did you know Vets for Pets are
the nation's most trusted vets?
We think that's because they're
locally owned
and locally loved.
Wherever you are,
we've got a vet local to you.
Vets for Pets. We're all for pets. Based on a survey. To verify, search vetsforpets.com/allforpets.
Sandy!
Where's? You're looking chirpy.
This gloomy weather is perfect for the London Dungeon. Got a great deal with SWR rewards.
Ooh, not bad. I got a deal on theatre and dinner, so I'm taking my girlfriends.
You are such a culture vulture.
Make every trip a treat with SWR rewards. Book a train from Chilworth today to claim yours. Southwestern Railway. Spread your wings. T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
A weather update coming up. We're also going to be checking in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. But here's a caller in Congleton. Jeff.
Hello, Nick. My brother-in-law spent a lot of time and money preparing a case for court, a dispute against the council. And when he went to court, obviously he was serious about this because of the damage to his car.
Oh, yeah.
Over a pothole, of course.
Right.
When he went to court, the lawyers and the judge, magistrates, seemed to be finding it derisory and laughable that he was even there trying to contest it.
Hmm.
So I got the idea that perhaps when they're spending money, loads of money on filling the same pothole over and over and over again, which happens on our street,
yeah,
the same potholes over and over again, they must be, I concluded that they must be spending more on lawyers than they are on filling the roads. Repairing the roads.
Yeah, patching up doesn't work in the long term, does it?
No, it doesn't, no.
And so what was the result of that case?
Oh, my brother-in-law, he was laughed out of court, and the lawyers for the council and the magistrate seemed to be in some sort of, you know, brotherly legal brotherly
in cahoots,
mutual admiration society.
Right.
Sorry.
Well,
about
they're
that.
Probably mates because they see each other every day. Yes. So we're on a hiding to nothing.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thanks for the bad news, Jeff.
Okay. All thanks, right. Nick.
Ta-da. 0345-6060-973. That's it. I was going to read some more messages, but I think I've got through a lot of them. My work is done in that regard. Right, let's talk weather.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
An amber warning for snow is in force in Scotland. There are multiple yellow warnings across the UK for winds and ice and rain and flooding. It's like winter outside. Let's talk about the prospects with John Ketley, the weather forecaster and broadcaster, who joins us on the line now. Hello, John.
Hello there, Nick. Well, there's a big change in the weather actually during Sunday because that amber warning was quickly displaced.
Oh.
The snow that was expected across in Scotland earlier in the day became very transient. And instead of snow, we actually saw the rain arriving, and it's brought a good deal of flooding to Scotland in the past few hours. So that's the major issue as far as the rest of tonight's concerned into tomorrow morning. There really is some quite nasty conditions. There are nasty weather conditions across much of Scotland, especially during tonight and into Monday. Now, the winds are also causing havoc as well. They've already started increasing to over 60 miles an hour in gusts, and they'll continue across that northwestern part of the UK in that same 12 to 18-hour period. So it is going to be pretty damaging up there, not to mention this flood water, which has now arrived because of the higher temperatures, which have also moved in during Sunday, and it's melting the snow very, very quickly. So you can't believe this. It can only be in Britain, really, couldn't it?
Yes.
Where you see such quick changes in the weather in just a few hours.
They were celebrating excellent snow conditions, and now it's all going to go away.
Well, most of it will do, even on the ski slopes. I think most of it will go away by tomorrow morning, by Monday morning. So we are seeing this huge change in the weather, but it is obviously going to be very nasty for anybody travelling around in Scotland into Monday because of all the floodwater that's around. Now, it doesn't mean to say that we've lost the snow forever. I think we are going to start to see more bands of rain moving in as the week goes on. And again, up on the Scottish Highlands there, it will be cold enough at times this week for some more snow to settle. But I think really we're looking at more normal conditions for this time of the year. Once we get through to the middle of January, we're normally looking at temperatures around about, well, let's say 6 to 8 degrees across most of the UK, and that's really where it's going to be for much of the time. Now, having said that, for Monday and Tuesday, across England and Wales especially, it is actually going to be very mild, just briefly. So we're looking at 10 to 12 degrees.
Wow.
So, you know, comparison, 10 to 12 degrees compared with just, 2 or 3 degrees above freezing during Saturday over much of the country.
Now, does this have anything to do with this storm that just hit us, this Goretti storm?
Well, Goretti's all cleared and away into central Europe and fizzled out now. It's a different thing altogether. This is a new area of low pressure which is moving up into northwest Scotland as I speak. It hasn't been named as far as I know, but it is bringing these pretty nasty and dangerous conditions to these northwestern areas. So it's just another one. It's another winter blast, really.
Right.
And that's going to move away, and we'll see further wet weather through the week.
Did Goretti hit us with the kind of strength that we're not used to in this country? Because they did talk of 100-mile-an-hour winds. I don't remember many storms that were that ferocious.
No, well, what was unusual about Goretti was it was a long way south. Normally, the winter storms are affecting Scotland in particular, and sometimes they go across central areas of the country. But this one only just clipped the south of England, so it was moving across the south coast at the end of last week, and it brought those devastating winds up to, 99 miles an hour, I think, on the Isles of Scilly. But the Channel Islands were badly affected. They had gusts over 80 miles an hour, and there were some quite dangerous conditions there in Jersey and Guernsey and Alderley for a short time. So that was the unusual thing about Goretti. It was named by the French, if you remember, because it was affecting northern parts of France more than anything else. But we got a glancing blow, if you like. It went through the English Channel. It did bring some very heavy rain and these fierce winds, but they were fairly restricted. And to the north of it, where it was still very cold, of course, we had that lying snow, especially across Wales and the Midlands. So we've had a real taste of winter in the past week or two.
Yes, it's odd that the storm, the weather came from the south, because as you said, it's normally coming from the north at this time of the year. That's why the wind is so bitter and cold.
Yeah. Yeah, but because it was in the south, it just It sort of attracted the colder air which was sitting over the country. Remember that northern Scotland's been under deep snow cover for the best part of 2 weeks since Christmas. Mm. Goretti moved across the south coast, and the backwash, really, if you want to call it that, it was dragging in that colder air from northern Britain. So it's not surprising that some of the rain that was around was turning to snow, even as far south as Wales and much of the Midlands as well. But we must also remember that parts of the Midlands are actually quite high. You know, you are looking at 200 metres or so, some of the ground there. So it was hardly surprising that we did get quite a good covering of snow in some parts of the Midlands.
Now, we're sort of almost halfway through winter, aren't we? Has it been a particularly unusual winter this time around?
Well, you'd have to say that every winter seems unusual, but having said that, every winter seems usual. Because there's no such thing as a normal winter in this country. There's no such thing as normal weather. Every wind direction brings its own weather, and every season seems to be different. And we can talk about the seasons changing in when they start to arrive and when they go away again. But, you know, life isn't so simple in the UK. It isn't so straightforward. We do get changes. We get different variations of weather in any season, in any week, quite frankly, in any month of the year. So I don't think there's anything normal about it. You say we're about halfway through the winter season, which we are, but very often, you know, we get some colder weather going into, say, March, and it's not unusual to have a covering of snow in March. So it's a strange thing.
Yeah, I recall from my youth that one year it snowed on June the 1st. Do you remember
Indeed
that?
Indeed it did.
Yes.
It must be your youth, Nick, because that was 1975.
Yeah, that's
so there
right.
We are. I remember it well. They were trying to play cricket in Buxton.
Well, given that we're halfway through, how far ahead can you tell with any degree of certainty as to what we're to expect?
Well, as far as this month's concerned now, we are in a month of variable weather, in the sense that we're going to be windy at times, we're going to be very wet at times too. So there will be flooding in different parts of the country in the next 2 or 3 weeks. But we're not out of the woods yet. I think there are still signs that we could engage this colder air from northern Europe. And so it could be that at the end of January, into February, we start to see colder winds return and a return of some snow. But that's just something that's in my thoughts. It's not a forecast at the moment.
Righto. Good to talk to you, John. Thanks so much for that. And broadcaster John Kettley. Now we're going to take a short break, and then we will be talking to LBC's Washington correspondent, Simon Marks.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
Thousands of Brits now use cannabis for medical purposes, so should it be legalised totally? And the Tories would ban social media for under-16s, but with plummeting literary skills, should we go even further?
Richard Spur at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Listeners, we interrupt the airways to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
A Southern Train is a place where you can have more me time. A chance to recharge yourself and your phone. To stretch out, sit back, and when you hear "all change, please," you'll know you already have. Go with your flow and save with advanced tickets at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
Find me somebody to love.
Hey, Beds, wake up. The Dreams Mega Clearance event is now on.
Sorry, I'm just so comfy.
I bet you are. There's up to 40% off a range of stylish beds and comfy mattresses. So shop now and save big. Dreams, love your bed.
Okay, who's all in for Cancer Research UK's Race for Life?
We're doing Pretty Muddy.
It's an obstacle course.
There's one for kids.
Runners.
Walkers.
Book clubbers.
Knit clubbers.
Tenpin bowlers.
Choir singers.
Lake swimmers.
Gardeners.
Whether you climb it.
Slide it.
Or crawl it.
Go all in against cancer.
All in to help fund life-saving research.
Sign up now
and save 30% off entry to your local 3K, 5K, 10K or Pretty Muddy event. Search Race for Life. Discount ends January 31st, 2026. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We are getting Simon Marks on the phone. He is LBC's Washington correspondent. There's some things that I want to talk to him about. There's a lot of protests going on over that ICE killing in America, in Minneapolis. We also want to talk about Iran and Trump considering military engagement in Iran. Some people in the Pentagon are urging him to delay, though, or perhaps postpone entirely. And the idea that Trump is only constrained by his own morality. So let's talk to Simon about all of that. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks. So, yes, these protests against this ICE killing of Renee Nicole Good, how widespread are they?
They are pretty widespread, and they are very substantial in number. For the last 2 days, we've seen significant mobilization of peaceful protests against ICE, obviously in Minneapolis itself, where the killing of Renee Nicole Good took place last week, but also as far afield as Los Angeles, here on the East Coast in New York, in an enormous array of cities and towns all over the United States. And I think that it poses a problem for President Trump, because it demonstrates that there are a large number of people out there in all sorts of cities all over the country who simply reject the lies that the administration continues to tell about what took place last week in Minneapolis when those fatal shots were fired. I see they've put out a new video tonight on the Department of Homeland Security's social media account, once again claiming falsely that Renee Nicole Good was trying to kill the ICE agent who fired those fatal shots, that she had weaponized her vehicle and was trying to ram him with it at high speed. I mean, it's simply not true. It is not borne out by any of the video evidence they have released, including video from the ICE agent's own phone. And what we've also seen over the weekend are attempts now in Democrat-run states and cities to try and at least constrain ICE actions, not necessarily by new laws, but by issuing agents with a warning. So, for example, Politico reported today that in Illinois, a state senator, Democrat, has now filed legislation that, were it to be passed, would bar anyone hired by ICE during the Trump administration from ever obtaining employment in state or local law enforcement. In New York, the governor, Kathy Hochul, again a Democrat, says she's going to support legislation that would allow residents to bring civil lawsuits against immigration agents with ICE and the Border Patrol for constitutional violations. In Tennessee, a lawmaker has filed legislation to prohibit federal immigration enforcement actions on school property. So we are seeing efforts, I think, really to try and to some extent constrain the operations that are being mounted and were mounted again in brutal fashion this weekend, particularly in Minneapolis, but in other places in the United States. There are efforts by Democrats now to try and circumvent some of those operations. But, you know, the biggest issue here is that in the days since Renee Nicole Good's killing, from President Trump on down, his government has given ICE agents the green light now to do whatever they want, including killing people. The Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, saying from the White House podium that her death was justified because she was a part of the lunatic fringe, part of this underground network of radical left conspirators. And that just sends, I think, a chilling message about where this country is heading. As you and I have both talked about many times in the past, there was never any doubt that something like this was going to happen. It was only a matter of time. And I think there now has to be a concern that there's going to be lots more of it.
Yes. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, said that the woman who was shot in the face three times as she slowly drove her car away from, not at the man, away from the man, she called the person who got shot three times in the face a domestic terrorist.
Well, I mean, the thing about Kristi Noem is that she is a proven serial liar. She lies all the time. I mean, if she's moving her lips, it is highly likely that she is lying. Democrats have absolutely excoriated her during congressional testimony, caught her out time and time again. She's been caught out over this particular incident in terms of many of the claims that she has made. But she exudes a confidence and the apparent backing of President Donald Trump. It wasn't that long ago that there were rumors here that he was planning to get rid of her. He wasn't happy with the pace of mass deportations, but there's been no move so far to engage in any kind of reshuffle. She, of course, is the woman who was thinking herself about running for the presidency back in 2024. She was thinking of challenging Donald Trump for the Republican Party's nomination. But all of that got undone by the publication of her memoir, in which she revealed that she had herself murdered the family's puppy because it was too rambunctious and she couldn't find any way of controlling it. So she took it out to a gravel pit near her home and shot it. And that, you know, did her in as far as the presidential aspirations were concerned. But, you know, she's now controlling mass deportation operations, a budget of $170 billion. This is now an enormously powerful woman who has an exceptionally loose grip on the truth and on facts.
Well, as you alluded to, this all seems very deliberate. When Trump pardoned those rioters from January the 6th, my initial thought, which I've said on the air several times, was that what Trump has done there is provided himself with a private army. Those people will do anything for him, and he will allow them to do anything. In fact, he will pre-excuse them for anything that they do. And this is, I think, the message. This is why they're all issuing the essential command to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears, 1984, to pre-excuse any of these ICE goons of doing anything. It's to instill fear in the minds of the radical left communist fascists, anybody who is not wearing a red hat, to protest against the government on any issue. The message is, if you protest against me, Donald Trump, you can be killed, and whoever does it will get away with it.
Yes, I mean, I think that is exactly the message that was disseminated to the public last week. If you get a chance, if you've not seen it, Jake Tapper today on CNN confronted Kristi Noem with video of January the 6th protesters on January the 6th, 2021, assaulting police officers. They, of course, then were later pardoned by President Donald Trump. And, you know, he was absolutely making the point that there is violence against law enforcement officers that Donald Trump has previously had no issue with whatsoever, and violence that was far more palpable and obvious than what Renee Nicole Good was doing, which was simply participating in a protest against ICE officers. And then when she was confronted by those ICE officers, smiling at them, saying she didn't have a problem with them and was seemed to be trying to move her vehicle.
Yes.
But you know, Kristi Noem is not going to be moved by any of that. I mean, the language that has been used over the last few days about this dark underground network of far-left radicals who are conspiring, not just against law enforcement here, but against Donald Trump's government, trying to stop the president from doing the things that he was elected to do. Well, we got to a point where rhetorically, Vice President J.D. Vance behind the White House podium found himself actually saying that he didn't think that members of that far-left underground conspiracy should face the death penalty. But he certainly thought that they should be sent to jail for many years. I mean, that's what he said behind the White House podium. And I think that when you talk about this being deliberate strategy, and we've discussed this before, this is an election year in the United States. We've got midterm elections in November, the whole of the House of Representatives and a third of the Senate up for grabs. And last week, in a speech to Republican lawmakers, the President of the United States found himself wandering down an avenue in which he said, I'm not going to cancel the elections, because if I cancel the elections, the media will call me a dictator.
Yeah.
But it was clearly an indication that somewhere in that mind of his, with its morality upon which the sanctity of the world now depends, somewhere in that mind of his, he's thinking about cancelling the midterm elections. Wow. And all of this aligns with the notion that, you know, if he feels like he needs to do it, he will invoke the 1807 Insurrection Act, put troops on the streets of Democrat-run cities and states all over the country, manufacture a concocted national state of emergency, and then say to the country, if he feels he needs to do it because he thinks he's going to lose control on Capitol Hill, you know, I'm awfully sorry, but the situation is so grave, we just can't possibly allow these elections to take place. The mere fact that he even articulated it and said he won't say let's cancel the elections, you know, the mere fact he even suggested that tells you he's been thinking about it.
Yes. Here's another scenario. This is why I think he wants to ban mail-in voting. Now, mail-in voting is used by many Republicans because they tend to live in poor states and they are far away from polling stations, so it's much easier for them. They're also older, so they find it more convenient. So you think, why is he determined to ban mail-in voting? Well, I would suggest that it would force people to go and queue outside their voting booth, where he will, in areas where he thinks he will lose the vote, install ICE goons who will start arresting people at random, shooting them if necessary, which will make the turnout plummet, and by that method, the Democrat states will vote far less, and the Republicans consequently far more, and then he'll win.
Well, I mean, look, I think there is all sorts of jiggery pokery that is possible, and much of it has already been taking place in terms of the gerrymandering, you know, the redrawing of constituency boundaries, for example, in places like Texas that the Republicans have engaged in, literally to try and create more Republican seats in Congress for them and fewer for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. He has an issue with this mail-in voting, though, because Republican lawmakers, unlike the president, recognize how important it is for them. And, you know, I mean, it's also just bizarre that he keeps saying that Vladimir Putin told him to get rid of mail-in voting. you know where they have mail-in voting? They have it in Russia, and Vladimir Putin implemented it. So, yeah, I'm sure he's telling him to get rid of mail-in voting because he knows that it will further sully American democracy. Hmm. So, you know, but I think that you are correct to identify the possibility of all sorts of dodgy activities taking place around those midterm elections so that he can also argue they were unfair, we can't, battle against the outcome of them, we can't accept the outcome of the election. And also there's a real potential that that's the playbook in 2028 as well.
Absolutely, and I think that there'll be a lot of false flag activity as well. He will instruct people to make things look suspicious, thereby necessitating Donald Trump to ride to the rescue of democracy.
Yes, well, we know from the last election that, you know, he's going to place these so-called election monitors all over the place at various counts, and that they will doubtless, as they did in 2024, until it became apparent that he'd won the election, stand by to make all sorts of claims of irregularities. I mean, he never makes claims of irregularities when he wins. It's only when he loses. Mm. But, I think that we do have to wonder whether the era of entirely free and fair elections in the United States has come to an end, because certainly Republicans absolutely are weaponizing elections. And I think it's important to say that in some states, Democrats too are engaging in that gerrymandering and the redistricting of constituencies redress the balance.
Well, exactly. Is that not in response to the gerrymandering that Trump started?
I mean, yes, but neither party here is completely a stranger to that kind of mucking around. I mean, it's been going on for decades here. The Democrats are not pure as the driven snow in that regard either.
Well, always a pleasure, Simon. I would move location frequently if I were you. Don't stay two nights in the same place. Thanks a lot. That's Simon Marks, LBC's US correspondent, talking to us there from, Washington. Now, if you missed any part of this show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, both of which will have the podcast of my Friday and Saturday night shows, exclusive to Global Player and the new LBC app. The thing to ask for is Nick Abbott of the Whole Show podcast. That's the Friday and Saturday show. This show is on there as well as a listen again feature. And on the LBC app, you can read the news from LBC. You can put those news categories in the order that you want to read them. You can pause and rewind live radio. No end of good stuff. Get Global Player app or the new LBC app for free from your app store. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4, it's Ian Payne. First, Richard Spur.
Morning, Nick, and good morning to you. Thousands of Brits are now being prescribed super-strength cannabis for mental health conditions, including anxiety and depression. So do you believe it's time that we were to follow many other countries and legalise it completely? And what's your experience of using that drug for good or for bad? But first, one of the UK's biggest teaching unions has called on the government to ban social media for under 16 over concerns about mental health and concentration. They want legislation to be tightened so big tech firms would face penalties for allowing kids to access their platforms. And it's been shown that children aged as young as 2 with the highest screen time used can say far fewer words than others. So this morning, should smartphones and tablets be withheld from kids under a certain age?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. Reports from the Middle East are claiming President Trump has committed the United States to intervention in Iran. Several sources in Washington have told the Jerusalem Post he's decided to help anti-government demonstrators, but is yet to decide how and when. Tehran has already warned the US it will retaliate if it's attacked. The military analyst Andrew Fox has been telling LBC any action will be considered carefully.
The Israelis over the summer showed an incredible saturation of Iran by their security services. They were able to hit some fairly impressive targets. For example, they managed to take out the entirety of the Iranian Air Force headquarters in one strike. So this is not going to be a random session of airstrikes.
Officials in Kyiv say part of the city is on fire tonight after a new Russian attack. Its military administration says attempts to repel the strike are ongoing. A British skier is being killed by an avalanche in the French Alps. He's believed to be in his 50s and was skiing off-piste at La Plan in the southeast of the country. The Met Office is warning heavy rain and melting snow and ice could lead to flooding this week. Storm Goretti hit the UK on Thursday, but forecasters are now warning of a rapid thaw across the north of the UK. The meteorologist John Ketley has been telling LBC Scotland is going to suffer.
The winds are also causing havoc as well. They've already started increasing to over 60 miles an hour in gusts, and they'll continue across that northwestern part of the UK. So it is going to be pretty damaging up there. not to mention this flood water, which has now arrived because of the higher temperatures, which have also moved in during Sunday, and it's melting the snow very, very quickly.
Police in Kent say a convicted robber has absconded from an open prison. 53-year-old Michael Dunn left HMP Stanford Hill on the Isle of Sheppey without permission on Saturday morning. And research is indicating the average adult in the UK gets two scam calls every